So some pictures of maybe I'll sit, huh? We'll see. My collaborators. The main one is Sebastian. Some of you know him, who makes a wonderful anatomical and mechanical work. And Knarik Bagdasarian, Ronen was a master's student, and Efrat did a PhD on the psychophysics that I'll show you. And Miriam, I don't have her picture, sorry. I skipped her. And Miriam, of course, she's in the Technion, and she collaborated with us on the some theoretical issues. Sachsenhaus. What's the source? You know the family?
No.
What is it?
If you read it in German, then it's Sachsenhaus.
House is house and
Saxons. Okay.
Okay, we'll start with a basic trivial slide which talk about the basic kind of codings that we think there are. The first one has to do with the organization of receptor arrays. Like in the retina, we have two-dimensional organization in which each photoreceptor is sensitive to a tiny area of the visual field. In the cochlea, we have this array of hair cells, which each of which is sensitive to a tiny range of frequencies. And under the skin, we have these mechanoreceptors, each is sensitive to a tiny area of the skin, pressure coming from them. And this gives rise to the trivial kind of coding that we're all familiar with, which is the spatial coding, in which the brain might tell the sensory organ, tell me which receptors are active, and I'll tell you what is the stimulus. But as we all know, the world is not stationary. This would be sufficient if everything was stationary. But the world is not stationary, and more than that, the sensory organs move. So, as you might know, the retina moves all the time. We talk about it. Even during fixation. So if you fixate on something, you have tiny movements which are on the order of some 20, 30 photoreceptors all the time. And the skin, at least, I'm not sure about the cochlea if there's any movement there, but the skin, when we want to feel something properly, we move our hands. We don't keep, if you keep the finger stationary, the image fades away. So we keep moving it. So all these movements give rise to second kind of basic kind of coding, which is temporal coding, in which the brain has to know the exact timing of activation of each receptor in order to know what's going on out there. Which motion?
It's Brownian motion, which is causing the hair bundles of all the hair cells.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which, with some substantial movement that can cause...
It's close to threshold for hearing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And it has certain frequencies, do you know? This is just random noise. White noise.
It's one for diastasis.
Who's?
It's the diastasis. The tip of my
Okay. Oh, okay. I see. Okay. Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about the tactile case, okay? This case, which is in which I focus experimentally. And we have, the, again, spatial coding and temporal coding. So spatial coding would be... don't have the white ones. So if we have the fingertip, we have, suppose we have... We feel a grating, okay, we put the fingertip on a grating, we have a series of receptive fields with some overlap, which will produce some pattern of activity along space. So if this will be the intensity of firing, there'll be some pattern across space just because the pressure provided to each receptor is different, okay, in space. This we call spatial coding. Now the temporal coding, if we have the same thing as I told you, if you just align the finger on the texture, we'll feel barely nothing. We have to move it in order to feel the texture. So if you have this grating, and we move, let's take one receptive field now, we move it across, what we get is we'll get one spike here, one spike here. And this is very reliable and very, I don't have the slide here, but there are several papers that show very clear time locking of this effect of this movement on the response of single cells in the periphery.
So what about this iron shift plot?
Intensity of firing, could be firing rate or sum of spikes. Number of spikes.
This is in case when there is no movement.
Right.
But you say when there is no movement, there will
be. It fades away. So when you, well, the code is there. So if you press, once you press it, you need to have transition. So once you press it, you'll have it and then it fades away.
So what did you plot?
Intensity of firing. Say, okay. Number of spikes. Could be firing rate or number of spikes. Spike counts.
Number of spikes. Overall.
Over the entire period. So suppose you start the epoch, you have the task, you put your finger, you either move it or don't move it. You take the entire period and you compare the firing in each in different receptors. Then you have, this is maybe analogous to the snapshot in the retina. So at a given time, if you freeze the image, either during movement or while pressing, you freeze it, you take a snapshot of activity, you'll have some pattern like this, depending on the relative location of the finger and the grating.
Well, you say snapshot and then you say overall period. Snapshot in my mind is something very brief.
I take it back, it's snapshot. It's not overall period, because if you take overall period and you move it, if you only press, you can take it overall period. If you move it, you smear everything. This is similar to the smearing on the retina. You cannot take it overall period.
Okay.
You can take the snapshots one after the other and then take the spatial derivatives here and then integrate this over the entire period.
So then this is not a spike count, this is just a
spike. Spike count per time beam. So okay, so if let's say if you just press it, okay, we don't move it, then it'll have some firing which will fade away. Okay, and here you'll have much less firing, also fade away. And here we'll have more. Okay, so this will be for this receptor. Okay, now if you move it, you start to smear it, and then you have to take snapshots, time beams, freeze it for a moment, and then look what happens. Okay,
then you get the same curve.
You'll get the same curve smeared. Okay, it will be less pronounced. Depending on the timing, if you take it on a millisecond time beam, you'll have it enhanced, but you'll have much less spikes. Okay, and here we already introduced by this discussion the problem of movement. You cannot rely only on spatial code, because spatial code would mean if you move the finger, and now this will once you move it, this will start to fire more and this will fire less because you move it. And then if it's periodic, you'll have it firing again, this more and this less. And then if you just integrate across the entire period, you'll have nothing. You'll have the total sum will be the same. This is the effect of smearing because of movement. Okay? So you have to take snapshots and you have to take it smaller and smaller if you want a sharp image. But what I want to describe is that, so it's clear from here that we have another dimension of coding, which is the time, the temporal dimension. Okay? And let me now isolate the temporal dimension. So as if we talk about the space of coding, which is spatial and temporal, okay, and the entire coding reside in this domain, this plane, but I describe to you only the reflection, okay, on the spatial coding axis, which is this one, if you freeze the image for a minute. And now let me tell you the projection of the coding on the temporal axis, which is if you take only a single receptor now and you examine its activity across time. Well, it will be true for each of the receptors here. So if you have this receptor, we'll have it time locked here. If you have this receptor, it will be again time locked here. And now suppose we have an offset here and we have another receptor here, it's timing of firing will be shifted in time, will be delta t. Okay, the temporal coding here is that delta t here, let's call it the interval, let's call it t maybe, here equals, let's call this, okay, make it delta t. delta t, delta x. It's delta x divided by v, assuming that velocity is constant. This is the velocity. Okay, if we have a constant velocity, at the encoding level, at the receptor level, we have a translation from spatial domain to temporal domain by this relationship. So this is the basic, the pure temporal coding. And of course, the entire coding, as I said, resides here in some special temporal coding, because we have the temporal coding. We have special effects in the temporal coding, which is the example of this delta t. We have to compare the timing of this receptor to the timing of this receptor in order to reveal these special offsets. And we have to take time into account when we deal with the special coding because of the smearing.
If you take snapshots here,
Here, yes.
You say when the first two receptors fire, it means that you are in location one. When they stop firing, then the third one fires, you are in the location two.
Again. If you take snapshot here,
then go in time and do snapshots.
Just tiny like this, or what?
Snapshot. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So first you see first two receptors fire. It means that you are in the location one. Right?
Yes.
Then you go further, you see they stop firing, and the third one fires. Then you know that you're in the location two. So every time, at every snapshot, you still have to know which receptor fired. You don't have to measure the time between.
You don't have to measure, but how will you know what is the amount of offset, of special offset?
Because you know that when the receptor.
You know the physical location of receptors. That's what we should say,
right? No, but you.
The same thing here. Huh? I understand the same thing, just you have fewer spikes.
No, it's not the same thing. Here you can't. Here we talk now in the language of the nuance. What is the code? If the code, and we talk now for the readout nuance. Okay, let's suppose we are the readout nuance. We take the information here, and we say, okay, let's read the code. Now I assume that there is only spatial coding as a readout circuit. I assume there is only spatial coding out there. Okay. If I assume this, I don't care about timing. I just integrate everything and look what is it.
Here you say you have to go by snapshot.
Yes, this is if I know that there is the time is involved, then okay, to the extreme, if I say there is only one dimension of coding, I don't care about timing at all. Now if I know the timing is involved, the solution could, there could be two solutions. Either I use the temporal information.
This works.
In coding.
In the snapshots, and every time you ask which receptor fires and which not.
Yes. Let me say it again. Say it again. If I, as a readout circuit, I assume only spatial coding, okay. I don't care about timing. I can integrate as long as I want. It should be stochastic here, and it shouldn't matter. Now I know that timing affects the coding. Okay, we know it because of the movement. You know, now there are two possibilities. One is the temporal effects are only disturbing. There's only noise because I have to do the movement because of some reason. And now I have, this induces some noise here, which is the smearing. This is one possibility. In that case, I'll try to overcome it by taking snapshot one after the other and try to construct the image by snapshots.
And here it won't work.
And here it will not work. Here, because the essence of the code is delta t. I mean, the code, the encoding of this delta x is in this delta t. You want to measure this delta t in order to know what is the delta x.
It seems that you don't have to measure. You just have to take the snapshots and see which receptor.
But then you have to know the delay between the snapshots in order to know what is the delta.
The receptive field of each receptor. So whenever receptor fires, you know that something at the given time is present at the receptor.
No.
You don't know how quickly you moved your head, right? The bars are really far apart. You moved your head very quickly, and you could get the same spike frame as if the bars were close.
No, but you have to know the velocity also to resolve the temporal coding. You have to know this. Okay? But you don't have to know it if you want to get just the pattern. Suppose you have a pattern like this. Okay, you can rely only on temporal relative temporal offset. Again, what? Say it loud.
My question, what do you want to know? You want to know where these things are?
I want to know the image. I want to know the shape of the image.
So it seems to me that if you know that some receptor is firing at a given time,
yes,
that something in the image is now present in the receptor field.
Yes.
So that's what you want to know.
No, you want to know that you have this shape and not, for example, this shape, okay? You want to discriminate between, let's say, this and this. Okay, let's take it simple. Mm-hmm. This
is the point that
and this.
That there's a scale factor. The scale factor is just set by the speed. You have two things like, you're saying I have two things like this and I move with a certain speed and I get shh, shh. And I can also have two things like this which are close and narrower and I'll get shh, shh. Or I can move very slowly and I get back to the first case.
Yes.
I can't tell between this and this unless I know.
No, I'm saying if you want to know, let's say if you want to discriminate between this and this, okay? You want to know if this fired before this or this one fired before this. You have to know delta T. Is it plus or minus?
Global picture, not so.
No, you want to know the pattern. So even this local pattern, you want to know if it goes to the right or to the left. You want to know the sign of delta T. Now, if you want to discriminate between this and this, you want to know the amount of delta T. You need to know the time.
Yeah, but you may say that all you want to know is at the given time, you want to know what the image is. So you want to know...
No, but you don't have the full picture.
Field, you have a stimulus or not.
So you don't have the entire image.
Then you just go by step.
Then you should integrate it.
Okay.
And then you should know the time.
This is the problem you're saying. You have the receptive field is only along x, and if you want to make, you want to bring up a fuller picture, you only have one position on x. So in order to make a full picture, that's why you need to know the time.
Right. You need the full picture, of course. You need the full picture of the image.
Global.
Sure. Yes.
It's like
yeah.
A scanning.
Yeah.
It's
sure.
Like
sure.
A scanner.
Sure. You can think about it a different way also. If you only take a snapshot, you have a limited resolution. Okay. You'll never know what is between.
So you need to integrate information across.
Yes.
The
yes.
But
yes.
That's obvious if you have a movement. Somehow you need to integrate.
Yes. Yes.
Time.
Yes. This is why I'm saying this is isolating the temporal domain. I mean, you could say I'm somewhere here, I'm taking snapshot and I'm measuring timing, what some other mean, not directly like this, but I take snapshots and integrate them. This is okay, then you'll get all the information. So this is just trying to isolate, take the two perpendicular coding schemes. Yeah.
On the left side, you were talking about intensity. So you could have two spikes, three spikes, four spikes within a certain time gain. On the right side, you seem to suggest that there would be only one spike per stimulus. What do you do if you get two spikes?
It's okay. Sometimes you get two spikes, yes. But they are very locked. The important thing is that they are locked to the transitions. You do get doubles, or depending on the intervals, you do get doubles. But they are locked to the transition.
As long as you can identify an event in the spike train, whether that event happens to be a single spike or a cluster.
Right, right. It doesn't matter. Right. You take a chance, right. You have some event, and it is determined or defined by its onset, actually. So you're right that I didn't describe it exactly the same. Yes. Okay. Okay, so we have the possibility to have these two coding schemes. The question is the temporal encoding used by the brain at all? Maybe it doesn't, as Misha said, maybe you don't need it. So for this, I want to show you results of psychophysical experiment that we did in the lab, which we think show it very clearly. So the task was to... every hand was given one of the gratings of this series of eight, and the question to the subject was, tell me which one is more dense, which hand you have a more dense grating. And what we did is, and this was, so he got these two hands, and we measured the velocity of the fingers by these two probes and infrared ultrasonic device. And what what we did is we eliminated the sensory cues. We eliminated once the spatial cues and second the temporal cues. How did we do it? To eliminate the temporal cues, we asked the subjects either to press it on off or to move the fingers up and down, but never move them across, so they don't have any temporal coding. And to remove the spatial ones, we asked them to wear gloves on which tiny pins were glued, and they could feel only the vibrations due to the movement, and this went to the entire finger pad. So there was no spatial information within the finger pad. Okay? And now the results were a bit surprising. What we got is that we had a lot of variability between the subjects, and then we made some cluster analysis, and we got two clear groups, and they are described here by the red and blue colors. We called one special temporal, and we called the other hidden temporal. Actually, we call them now latent temporal, and you'll see in a minute why. So if you just ask them to scan normally, without glove, without anything, the spatial temporal perform it reasonably good. These are naive subjects, and the task is not easy. We do it reasonably good. Chance level is at 50. And the blue ones perform it significantly worse. Now, if you remove the temporal information, okay, we ask them only to press up and down or to move it like this, but never move it across, all the subjects go down significantly. This one goes to chance level, and this one still can resolve the task, but with very low success rate. Sorry? The blue and the red? These are two groups. We began with 10 subjects, then we had another 20, so we had 30 subjects, about 14 and 16 divided to two groups based on I'll show you later based on what, actually. Okay, so this was the result of cluster analysis on their performance. I'll show you in a minute on what. Then when we remove the spatial information came the surprise. This latent temporal group performed much better than their normal performance. They performed as good as these good subjects normally, while the good subjects perform pretty poorly with the gloves, okay? And actually, this was the basis for this cluster analysis. We took the correlation of all these 30 subjects, the performance of during the normal, during vertical and during glove, and just compute the correlation coefficients.
Can you hear the sound they're making as they scan?
No, they have earphones. That's a good question. Yeah. Because you could hear it sometimes with the pin. So this was the basis for the classification, actually. Correlation coefficient of their performance across all, this is average results, but we tested across different spatial frequencies, and we made this, calculated these correlation coefficients.
Is standard error?
Yes, across subjects. Okay. Yes, it would be. So this is for the initial 10. This curve, no, this is, yeah, this. Yes. But you know, to estimate, if you try to estimate the overlap between them, right? It will be, if it's 10 is square root, yeah, 3 times, right? So they might overlap here. But to estimate the difference between the means, right, the significance, you use the standard error. It's very robust. I'll show you the other parameters, but let me show.
The order of the testing was it always the same way? They did first the normal?
Yes. And then we made control because of learning issues. Then we made control. The order was the same, and it was in blocks. They made all, it wasn't randomized. And there was a reason for that, and the reason was that we wanted to see the scanning strategies in each of the types, okay? And what we did What we found with this examining these scanning strategies was that these subjects, the blue ones, they used to begin with, they used very high velocities compared to those, to these ones. These ones used velocities that caused temporal frequencies around between 20 to 30 hertz at the end, if you multiply special frequency by velocity. Okay, so it induced temporal frequency at a single receptor of 30 hertz, 20 to 30. This one induced twice and more higher velocities. This is one thing, and the other thing is that when they move from here, from the normal scanning to the alter, to this scanning, to the glove scanning, they switch from simultaneous hand to one at a time, something like this. So what we did, we said that there could be two possibilities. One is that there is some masking effect of this spatial, when they have the spatial cues available, it interferes with their performance. Or the other possibility is that it's a strategy problem. They don't choose the right strategy of scanning. So to test this possibility, what we did was to try to guide them to use the strategy that was used by the other subjects. So to reduce the velocities down and to use hand by hand in normal scanning, not in the, not with the gloves. And when we did it, we just let them this 5 or 6 sessions to practice at low velocity and at one head at a time, and they improved in normal scanning now. So they were very poor at the beginning, and they improved to the levels that they did with the gloves and the levels that these good subjects did to begin with. Now, to test if this is could be just the effect of training without any relation to the strategy, we took another group and we asked them to just train on the task without any guidance. They did not improve. Once we started the guidance, immediately they jumped to the level of the good ones.
After they train, if they then put the glove on, are they still the same?
We didn't test this. What we did at the end, after guidance, this is a control session, and this is the control session for the Qian. We just asked them, okay, now do what you want and recover your own strategies. They found it very difficult to go to the previous high velocity. They couldn't understand how they used it before. And they actually stick to the new ones. So we take this as a strong indication that the temporal cues are important. First, because when you remove temporal cues, you reduce the performance of all of them. And second, this particular group, if you let them emphasize, use the strategy that emphasizes the temporal cues, they perform better. And why do I say emphasize? Because the frequencies of 20 to 30 hertz, which were caused by these low velocities, are the best frequencies of the rapidly adapting receptors in the fingertip. And the rapidly adapting receptor in the fingertip are those that are locked, that fires locked to the stimulus. Yeah. Okay, so this is ecophysics, and so this is to convince us that
do you understand what strategy they're using now?
Sorry?
Do you understand what strategy is being used?
So we take it, we understand part of it. So part of it is to use velocities that emphasize the rapidly adapting pathway.
Could they actually be tuning their velocity to
They are.
To achieve the best frequency and then using that as the
They do. We have. We can go more. I have the pictures from the paper somewhere here.
So if that's true, why would that be a temporal process?
What if they tune?
I would just be adjusting the velocity of my finger to
according to the special frequency.
To make the temporal frequency keep the temporal frequency fixed.
Okay, so you know what?
Let's just the intensity of the photoreceptor, right? The intensity of the somatic receptor input.
So what they do tune. They tune the velocity according to the special frequency. Actually, and the results are very, very strong.
A fixed tempo. To me, they get a fixed tempo frequency?
Close to, not fixed, but close to, I'll show you. It's...
It's sort of like you trust your... I sort of heard both sides of the story.
Yeah. So first,
can you read Braille? Can you adjust your fingers?
It's not known. Yes, we are going to test it now on blind people. Yes. So first, this is pretty strong. This is the temporal frequency. I'm sorry, I just took it from the PDF file. It's not great. This is the temporal frequency now, from 0 to 100. And the special temporal, the good subjects, when they do normal scanning or glove scanning, they keep these frequencies between 15 to 30 hertz. This is average across all subjects. Now the latent temporal, they start with high. It's very difficult to see. They start with high. Let's take. They start with high frequencies. This is 40 to 60 hertz here, and as we start the glove session, they jump to this. They move to this 20 to 30 hertz. Okay. Now, the tuning that they do to keep it, the red is normal scanning, and the green is the glove scanning. And this is again temporal frequency, and this is special frequency. Okay? With normal scanning, the temporal frequency went up with the special frequency because they actually kept the velocity pretty much constant. Now you can see the difference. In the glove scanning, they try to keep the temporal frequency limited to a smaller range, although it was not very constant. The range that they kept it between was between 15 to 20 to 30 hertz, okay, the entire range. And it makes sense according to what we think about the temporal decoding process. I'll show you. So this is the effect of this feedback. Okay, so we think it's important for primates, and then when we thought about possible decoding schemes, we thought about these three, and maybe some of you can come up with more, but basically I think these are the guys. And the idea with the delay lines would be like in the inter-aural decoding of inter-aural need my voice back. Okay, so suppose we want to decode this temporal temporal period, okay, in order to reveal the spatial frequency of the stimulus. So this is, the code is now in delta t, and we have this single neuron with this pattern of firing. We could feed a delay line with this spike pattern, and to put at the end a coincidence detector taking the same line, the same signal to it. Okay, and the coincidence detector is an element that will fire only when delta t is zero. Okay, delta t between its two inputs is zero, it will fire a spike. Okay,
and you're having many, many lines.
Right, and then you should have many, many lines, each tuned to a different delay. Let's say we're talking about 50 milliseconds, 49, 48, whatever, until 1 millisecond, and you feed this line to all of them, and you feed this line to all of the coincidence detectors, and then the one that you'll have what you get here is a labeled line coding. The one that will fire, either a burst or a spike, will be the one whose delay was present in the spike train.
In the inter-aural case, it's not done.
In the inter-aural case,
delay line, but you need
two. Right. You have two. Instead of this, you have this coming from the other ear. Yes. So you have sort of an cross correlation. It's basically an implementation of a cross correlation technique in the inter-aural delay and an autocorrelation technique here, basically. But it's the same.
could also have a latch and a clock. I mean,
again?
I mean, since you made this open, you could have a latch and a clock. The first pulse latches it, and a little clock starts counting.
Right. Okay. So now the open, what I call the open loop oscillator, is using the same idea now, but instead of delay lines, you use a bunch of clocks, and each one has a different basic frequency. So you have again the same, and you have some reset operation here.
Let me explain a little bit better. What should be the outcome of this all models? Is the neuron which is tuned for delta t?
Okay, so this is actually a good question, because who knows what should be the output. When we say decoding, we want to decode this delta t, but actually we don't have a decoding, because we do not restore the actual input. We don't restore the grating. It's not like in a radio demodulation when we restore the audio signal that was transmitting. So what we have is only a series of transformations in the brain that will eventually lead to the motor action or to the cognitive effects. So what we should talk about is transformation from one neural code to another. And the other neural code should be a neural code which is suitable for A, motor actions, and B, integration with other sensory modalities, and maybe C, perceptual, whatever, events, nobody knows what it is. So what I take as a neural code which can do all these, I talk about a rate code. So we know that rate code can control movements. I mean, this was shown by Georgopoulos and these guys. We know that rate code correlate with perception, Newsom-like stuff. And we know that rate code can integrate, rate code is the code used by these spatial mechanisms. Okay, so if you have other pathways talking with the rate code, then if it translate this temporal code to a rate code, it will be able to talk with them, to integrate with them.
What should the input be?
So the input is this delta t, these spike trains.
So I just want to back up. I don't know about what the receptors do. So this is supposed to be a model for some kind of central.
This is a model of decoding the temporal information after the receptors. So we have the receptors at the
front. Receptors are giving you're assuming one or two spikes per.
Right. We're assuming a short burst per grating line when the finger moves. Okay. You missed the first part.
So what about the best frequency? So how does that?
Oh, it will fit, the best frequency.
How does that show up then in the...
Here, the best frequency, okay.
Number of spikes in each burst?
No, the period. Let me clean this a little bit.
This should fit your experiment with the glove, right?
Right. Isolation of...
That you really integrate over all receptors in...
I take it to the extreme, and I'm saying that the temporal code reside in each single receptor. Now, in the GLAD experiment, it multiplies across all receptors. They'll all have it the same. They'll all transmit the same thing. The best frequency is 1 over this period. The 15 to 30 hertz. When I calculated the F, which is...
I thought the
period is always going to be
the temporal frequency
at
which the
grading
is encountered.
Right.
So, but the chances of getting a spike
per beat,
that's what's changing with the frequency, right?
No.
Except it's tuned to some...
No. Here, this is one-to-one. This is well-known phenomena in tactile perception. That you have in this frequency range between, I think, 10 to 40 or something like this hertz, you have one-to-one locking in the periphery, in which you have either one spike or doublets.
Irrespective of frequency?
No, within this range. So you have the plateau range, what Mountcastle called the plateau range, in which you get, it's something like this with the frequency. Here is a one-to-one ratio that you get for each bump. You get one spike. With lower frequencies, you get more. You get bursts of doublets or triplets, but they're still locked. And with higher frequency, you start to miss some of them.
So what's the best frequency? I mean, there are receptors, three classes of receptors, right? In three different domains of
right.
frequencies.
Yes, so they have
and they're tuned, right?
Yes, they have the families. I have this figure somewhere. The families, they have there were one or two groups plotting the bandpass parameters. It's something like let's see, at 5, 30, and 300. So the slowly adapting has some peak here. The rapidly adapting is here, and the Pacinian is here around. So rapidly adapting, it's, don't take it literally, but.
Let's just back up. So that graph that you drew right there with the plateau, so the horizontal vertical axis is number of spikes per cycle.
Right.
And so, okay. And so now what is the graph you're drawing on the left? What's the vertical axis?
There. Sensitivity, which is let me see, here it goes, here it goes with the minimal indentation depth that you need to activate a spike. So the sensitivity of these receptors across different frequencies.
It's like spikes per micron.
Spikes, yes, per micron indentation, yes, something like this. Yes.
Frequency and
right, it's amplitude sensitivity and frequency. Sensitivity.
In
terms of frequency, so, okay, what people sometimes, because of the analogy with with vision and hearing, they pay attention a lot to this sensitivity. Actually, the Braille. There are devices for the blind called opticon that oscillate small needles to the skin. They developed them in the vicinity of 300 hertz because they thought about this sensitivity, because the Pacinian sensitivity is higher than the other three. The approach to look at this, the sensitivity of these neurons as the range in which they produce one-to-one firing is not so wide. There are a few labs that look at it, emphasize it, and other labs not. But in the sense of coding, this is indeed the important tuning feature. Okay, in which range they fire one-to-one.
So this one-to-one experiment, you have dense and less dense.
Yes.
But they are within a ratio of 2 or so?
Between 200 to 800, or a ratio of 4 altogether.
Four. So will they both fall on the plateau in some sense? Kind of.
Depending on the velocity.
Yeah, but they adjust the velocity so that both will fall within the plateau?
Yes. So not in the, so in the glove, when they perform good, this is what happens. So between 15 to 30 hertz is the range for the rapidly adapting to fire one per one.
How do you know they're using? Why should we assume they're using the rapidly adapting to this?
We don't know. We don't know.
This is
the model, right? Because of the frequencies.
Now the other classes don't have this one-to-one model.
It has. It has. They could use a slowly adapting. It has. It's somewhere here, I think. Now this is not very well. Very well. There's one paper from Mountcastle 68, and another from another group at some 20 years ago, with different kind of graphs, etc., that you have to take it from there. So it's not, you know, well-studied issue. The rapidly adapting were well-studied in this issue. The slowly adapting were less. But they have a plateau range. It's less pronounced.
So if I increase the amplitude, the number of spikes per...
You know what, actually, I'm not sure even that they have... According to Mountcastle, they don't have a plateau range. According to the other group, they have some range. Yeah, let's put
it. I'm just trying to understand. So the rapidly, that curve you're drawing there, that is between
the difference between getting zero spikes per cycle and one spike per cycle, right? There's a threshold.
No. This is the.
I'm varying the amplitude of the stimulus.
Right.
The mechanical stimulus.
Yes, and then it's between 0 and 1, yes, when you start getting...
You never get more than 1
in this curve, yes, in this curve. No, here you can get, if you... During the plateau, if you press strongly, you'll get it. If you use the light touch...
So this moves also with the intensity. This
yes.
curve is not universal.
Yes, it's not universal. If you press very hard, yes, but you have a certain...
There's some range of amplitude.
Some range, which is the range of light touch, of scanning touch, in which you have one-to-one. Yes.
So to summarize, there's a plateau range in force, and there's a plateau range
right.
in speed with which you get one spike per contact.
That's true.
Contact,
that's true.
It's a sort of island.
That's true, yes. That's true.
But then going back to the output of it. So the output of the model should be a neuron which is tuned for delta t. So its firing rate will be a function of delta t. That's what you want for the output.
Yes. Right. So you have, right. So you have, you should have delta t is the input. Okay, and we want some monotonic function of it, and the variable here would be something which goes with the rate.
Firing rate.
So here you can take this is, you can think about, I mean, this is a label line. If it's exactly tuned, if it's widely tuned, it will be a population code of okay of some sort.
So this is exactly like an interval problem. Find the neuron which is tuned for the
interval. Yes. The issue of temporal coding is the same. The problem is similar. It's different time scales. In inter-hour differences is microseconds. Here it's milliseconds. And here you want to find also the periodicity within a single strain, but in principle it's the same. Same problem.
So did you say why delay lines?
So no. So I'm saying one possibility is delay line. The other possibility is instead of this to use just oscillators that you reset them, let them go. It's a clock and it's tuned, let's say, to 3 milliseconds. So once you fire it, it will fire the next spike after 30 milliseconds, and then you compare. And these two I call open loop approaches because the output does not feed back to the process. Okay, you have to prepare a set, an array of predetermined values to which you compare the input. Okay? Okay. So
again, sorry. Yeah. In the experiments, there are no offsets, right? You can just
right. This is I just put it. Let's forget it.
Zero.
Forget it. Just put it to say to show another aspect of the temporal code.
Then all delta t's will be zero.
And then what?
All delta t's will be zero.
Between different receptors, yes.
So how will you then?
I call now delta t this. I'm sorry for this diffusion. I'm calling the period. The period delta t. Sorry, I confused you with the previous one. It's now we're talking about the detection of the frequency, not phases between one to the other, but the frequency of each receptor.
This becomes like a usual firing rate of a neuron. It's just delta t between the spikes of a neuron. So you want to decode the firing rate of a neuron?
No, we want to decode. We take the issue of. Let me show you what when it comes when you see the difference clear. This is in.
Can you explain a bit more about the selection
function? Yes. What you do here is you have an oscillator. Oscillator is an element that it will, if you fire it once, let's take the model of the after hyperpolarization, it will recover and then fire by itself another spike. Just because you started the process, it will go on. At least once. Sometimes it will die. So what you do, you reset it. You have a slight temporal problem here. You have to induce some delay. Short delay. You reset it, you let it go, and then it will fire after, let's say, 30 milliseconds. Okay, so you reset it by one spike. Okay, there'll be some delay between this input to the output here, so it will not coincide with the spike that reseted it. Let's say you give here a spike. This is the spike, the input spike. Okay. It will fire it, but this will have a delay, so it will not coincide here. And now, if it will have the 31, let's say, if this is 30, and this is 31, sorry, 29, one before, just to keep the numbers, this is 30, and this is 31. 31, then the next spike will coincide in the coincidence detector. But it will not coincide for the 29, 28, 20. Okay, so again you have this label line.
So it's like inducing a delay.
Yes, but different element. Why I'm saying it? Because people from. That studied the BET and the inter-aural delays and electric fish, in which you find this delay line mechanism, they say that it's good for delays that are less than 4 milliseconds. I mean, even in this range, it starts to be unreliable because these mechanisms are based on axons, length of axons, and it's limited. Now, we talk about tens of milliseconds, maybe hundreds of milliseconds. So delay lines are probably not a good element for this task, but oscillators are. So you can think about an analog, exactly the same thing, just with the clock. And the third possibility is to make this decoding more elegant. We can close the loop. Actually, you can close also the delay line loop, but we'll talk only about this thing. Here you have to keep array of all predetermined values that you want to decode. But in principle, you could take one oscillator. Only one oscillator and compare it with the input. So we have the input here. But now feed the output back to the oscillator. If you have this adaptive circuit, in principle, one oscillator is enough to decode all possible inputs and with then basically infinite resolution. Basically.
But isn't that just transforming the problem? You're just making that internal oscillator go at the same frequency as the external oscillator.
Right.
Why is that solving the problem?
What again?
Why is it solving the problem? Why is it solving
the problem? Why is it decoding anything?
Yeah.
Okay. So
an error signal?
Sorry?
Because there's an error signal?
Yes, I'll show you. It's the best way to show it is the following. You have now let's talk about back to the question of Misha, because it will lead us to this. It's not here.
I mean, I guess what I'm trying to understand, if you want to find delta t, why can't you just think at the level of a single cell, and the more spikes that come into that cell, the higher the accumulation of some slow variable like calcium. And suppose that calcium is controlling the...
Okay, so you're talking about average firing rate. Is it average firing rate? Okay. This would be true if we talk only about constant frequencies. If the only task of the system was to detect constant frequencies, you're right. But these gratings are very, very, indeed, simplistic stimuli. They are not real stimuli. So real stimuli, this is not also real stimuli, but let's say we have a texture, which is not just straight lines, okay? And we scan it. What you get out of it here is you get a structure in the temporal delta t's. Okay, it's a pattern now of delta t's. And this will be different than if I have this spaced differently, although I can have the same average number of bumps across, if I move, say, in the center or move here, I'll have the same average number of bumps, but they'll be arranged differently in time.
So the only way of saying it is that if you just counted spikes, it would take a long time to discriminate.
No, you cannot do it. You have the same number of spikes.
Even.
It will take much longer, yes.
If you count spikes, it takes a long time.
I agree, yes, right. That's true. But this is the general case.
It's harder to do time varying. It's it's harder to take care of a time varying stimulus because it takes a long time.
Right, to compute the average. Right, right. And here it's just the arrival of the next spike will tell you exactly the modulation. So the general story, and here we go back a little bit to the slowly adapting, rapidly adapting, here is that you have both amplitude modulations of the bumps and temporal modulations. Now the nice thing about the system is the slowly adapting receptors are very sensitive to the amplitude modulations. And within the and the rapidly adapting, within this plateau range, they are not. It's like you cut, you eliminate. For the rapidly adapting, you eliminate all the height information. You don't have it. You have only the temporal information. But this is a side issue. So we have this information. Now, how can we think about it? We have, let's say, this is the spike pattern. Now, we can think about, and we want to decode it or to represent it by firing rate. So we can think of this.
In this case, what is the desired output? Is the neuron which jumps from one rate to another?
Yes. Here, it'll be a different rate code for each interval.
So what the desired output is a function of time.
Desired output is not unique, but you could have a population. Okay, one possibility. Okay, is that you have a population code. Let's say this is the population firing rate. Okay. And it will tell you, okay, this here I had the delta t, and the relationship is linear between delta t and r.
Okay.
So you have some population code. In this case, what you should have is you should have this population code. Right? You have high, low.
In this case.
In this case. Actually, here it will be rectangular. In this case, it will be just. I'm talking about this one now.
I'm confused. Do you imagine getting an answer in the steady state, which is sort of implied by making a phase lock loop, or do you imply getting an answer?
No. He asked for the what is the purpose of modeling? What do I expect from the output? How do I envision the output? So I envision it like this. Now. Right.
But that's just restating the input.
The
stimulus you have is described by two numbers, right? Or four numbers,
yes.
Including amplitude.
Well, right? Input is just a spike.
Okay, wait.
Yes.
Let me finish my question. The bumps that you're rubbing against are described by four numbers. And is the desired output in some sense those four numbers? Or is desired output a replication of the force on the finger?
No. The desired output is these four numbers. Desired output is the representation of this, of the pattern of the texture.
Okay, so there should be four neurons whose rate is some combination of their rates. As we go back to the distance between those little blocks and the amplitudes of the little blocks on the surface.
Well, wait about the amplitude. Amplitude is a different, will be different.
So there's two numbers then.
We talk now about only the decoding of the temporal.
Yeah,
two numbers.
But you get two rates that give you.
Right. But so suppose you have the finger covering all this, okay? So for these neurons, it will be this story. For the neurons, the decoding of this information, there will be.
I'm still confused. Why do you draw a plot then that has rate varying in time? I would have thought you would have had like two neurons whose rates are constant, and those represent one delta t, and the second one represents the other delta t. That your output there is rapidly changing in time. Okay, and I would have thought that decoding would have meant I get two. In steady state, I get two numbers.
No. Right? So okay. So let me put it in the framework. What I'm talking here is about the first level of decoding, a very early decoding. At the end, if you want to think about the abstract level of representation in the brain, there'll be something that tells us this is a Persian rug or something. Okay. This is at the end.
Yeah, but somewhere in the middle is.
No, okay. I'm not talking about the middle even. I'm talking about now. What I tried to do is to bring the temporal coding to a level in which it can speak to all other kind of coding, including visual. Okay? And this level is the weight coding level. So if I brought this coding, okay, to the language of weight, then it can speak with the amplitude decoder, it can speak with the visual decoder, and you can build this your Persian rig. Okay?
And so roughly the way you're going to do that is to take a population of cells, have them tuned to different tempo frequencies, and then pick out the one that's pulling out that particular tempo frequency from the input. So if you think about your set of delay models,
yes,
you've got a single input and a whole bunch of outputs. Each of the outputs is tuned to a particular tempo frequency in the input.
Yes.
By looking across that population.
Right. In this will be the output of this circuit. The output of that circuit will be a population code, okay? In which this R now will be a population code and here, or a vector, which says in this manner, will say, okay, neurons from 0 to 30, okay? This would be neuron number 5 firing, and this would be neuron number 23 firing. Okay, but it's a weight coding scheme because it's the question is who is firing and how much.
Okay. This one runs.
This one? Okay, so let me describe you this one. Okay, so.
Yes. By explaining the feedback with the oscillator.
Yes, yes. They
don't understand how it works.
Sure. We initially wanted to know the end result of it. So.
Have you plot this R below the spike so the
now it's right to the oscillator.
Okay, so
you're not trying
okay.
to factor out. I mean, maybe this is getting off the deep end, but you're not trying to factor out delta t. You might have thought that at some level
to factor out
evolving, right? You have an input that's evolving at time, but you're in steady state, as you said. And then what you want to do is not have an output which reaches a steady state value, which does not evolve in time. But your model evolves in time.
Right. My model is only reading the temporal code and translating it into a rate code.
But the problem
that's all. Not solving the entire issue.
See, the desired output is a rate that goes up and down, up and down, up and down.
Right, right.
The input is already a spike rate, his rate is going up and down, up
and down. Who? Here?
Yeah. So it's not.
Well, as you said before, I mean, if you just assume average rate, you don't have the resolution. But what do you mean? If you take now what? Integration of this, you have the instantaneous rate. You need this. But you don't. In the glove case, you have. But in this case, you don't. You have every receptor for its own. You have all the receptors. Each of them has a temporal code.
So you want to take one spike train as an input and transform it into a population firing,
right,
which you can estimate.
In which delta t is translated to accurate rate. Yes.
But it's just recovering the input, right?
Recovering the input.
Sebastian's saying is take this input and send it straight to these higher level.
Send it to the
all the analysis. This is only just recovering the input.
Send it to the motor output. Maybe it'll do something.
No.
I mean, what the brain is doing? It's not recovering inputs and translating them to some internal representations so that he can do something with them.
Okay, let's just go ahead to the solution and see if it gives you more.
But it gives you more than this, of course. But even in this basic level, you need it. Okay. So you need accurate decoding of this. So what is the idea here? The idea of this phase lock loop is that you have every pattern like this. You can describe as a carrier pattern modulated by some modulation function. Which means, okay, if we say. The frequency of here. So the frequency of let's call it F input. Okay, frequency of the input of the input equals, or let's talk about temporal delays. Maybe it's better in this discrete analysis. Okay, so this is T input. So T input equals some T carrier, which is this T, okay, plus some modulation signal. Let's call it some factor times what measure I use, let's say. So this pattern is a carrier modulated by some modulating signal, which is R, and R is negative here, is positive here because it's increasing, it's negative here again because it's decreasing. Okay, positive, negative, which means the final output of the pattern is this carrier modulated by the R signal, which either shrink or elongate the temporal interval.
But R is sitting at another arrow into your X, which is your correlator up on top.
Okay, why did I take it? Okay, because I want to compare them. So this is R prime, okay? I have a purpose in it. This is R prime. Okay, so this is the modulating signal, actually.
Okay, R is, that's the output of your cross?
Huh?
The input to your cross has...
This is the input. This is the input to the cross. Okay, this is Ti. This is the pattern that the temporal pattern that I put in. This is the spike rate.
O is the other input to the cross, right?
And let's say To, okay, will be the other input to the cross, okay? And the output here is R prime.
And is To?
Huh?
In your picture here, you labeled it O. That should be.
Where do you see O?
C.
Oh, C. Carrier. C for carrier.
It should be T-O. T-O is the carrier? No.
T-O is the actual signal here. The carrier right now is an imaginary signal which doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. I mean, it's just I describe this actual pattern by a carrier, which is the average frequency. The carrier has a fixed frequency, but it's modulated down and up, down and up, down and up. Okay,
this carrier has the same number of spikes as
right,
T.
Right.
C has the same number.
Right. C has the same number of spikes as Ti.
And R
is just telling us what is the period at this given.
I drew R based on T.
Yeah, I thought your R should be all negative. I mean,
should be what?
The spike in each of the input spikes is before the carrier spikes. So why is the R always negative?
You talk about the
number of spikes. I think the spikes.
No. The temporal. Wait a second. Ti is a series. So Ti actually is a function of is a series. Okay, it's Ti of n. R of n. This is n. This is n. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So to be accurate, Ti describes the interval of every spike from the previous spike. Okay? So this interval is determined by the carrier, the basic period, plus the modulation. Either negative or I'm not sure where to put this.
It's okay.
Okay, so
n equals Tc of n, but Tc is constant.
Ti of n equal Tc is constant, plus gamma is just a constant, translation constant, and R change every n. Okay? So this is Ti, this is the input. Now the philosophy of this loop is it has two stages. One is that this is a negative feedback loop which has a set point. And its set point forces this oscillator forces TO to be equal to TI. Okay, plus could be plus a constant delta constant delta t. Okay.
Now I'm kind of confused. You're saying that oscillator. So there's no integrator. So that oscillator is
no integrator.
It's not a pure sine wave. It's just.
No. It's the same. Yes, right. It's the same spike generator. Same neural oscillator that generates a spike train. Okay. That has to be a temporal replica of Ti. We have different colors.
If I close that, I can just have one cell driving the other.
Okay, but then you get nothing. Then you get nothing. You get everything by achieving this locking via the loop. If you just one drive the other, you get nothing. This is not the target. This is the tool of the system. So we have TO here. It's the same spike train, just with a temporal delay, fixed temporal delay.
T0.
T0, okay.
So yes. Let him explain first how it
is. After the feedback.
Okay, so if we achieve it first, then what we have, this equals this, and now, if we achieve it, and if we build TC here, the carrier frequency of this modulator, equal to TC, we build them the same way. Maybe the best way to show it will be to say that the way that I generate TI, I could imagine, is again taking an oscillator which has a TC as a carrier frequency and a modulation input R that modulates the TC. Okay, to achieve this.
TC is not an input, TC is a descriptor.
TC is the average.
Yes, a descriptor, yes, I don't know how to, yes, right. Has the same TC. Okay. It's a feature of this oscillator. Okay.
That's not controlled by the feedback
loop.
I understand.
I confuse it with this. Forget about this. If we achieve this locking, okay, then what we say is that. This locking is one requirement. The other one is the TO, we'll use a different color, TO equals also, this is an oscillator which has TC prime, some its own carrier frequency, plus gamma R prime N. Okay, this is an oscillator, okay, which has a carrier frequency, whose frequency can be modulated by its input. Its input is R. Okay, with the same translation constant. So as if I have two similar generators of temporal pattern. One is in the transmitting end, which sends TI, and this is this one, this sends TI. And one in my local decoder, okay, which I build here, which generates TO. So assume I have two similar oscillators that generate one that transmitted TI that arrives to this circuit, and the other one generates the local model, if you wish, of this TI, which is TO. I'm talking about transmission, etc., because this is exactly what happens in radio receivers of FM decoder.
No.
That produces FM decoder.
It's not.
Not exactly, but in principle. But wait. Let me just get this clear.
Exactly not.
Exactly not. Okay. It's just the opposite of this. Okay. So let me just get this clear, just to finish, and then we'll see. So TO is a local model of TI, so to speak, generated by this local oscillator, which has a carrier frequency of TC prime, and is modulated by this local signal R prime. Now, if we, and Ti we said is this one. If you take, make sure that Tc prime equals Tc, okay, and we make sure that gamma equals gamma, then we get R prime equals R.
Modulo delta 2.
Again? Yes. Delta T is a constant. Okay, R is the dynamic one. It's R, right, R equal, so what we'll get is R prime of N equals R of N. Now either, you know, could be, if delta T is a cycle, is minus one, but if no, just minus a constant. A fraction of a cycle or something.
I don't understand what phase gets you here. I mean,
again?
Again, the way you drew it, the oscillator, the local oscillator is just following the input exactly. I don't see why you need to close this in order to.
How do you make it? How do you make it follow the input? How do you make it follow the input?
By design, you've given this thing a frequency, which is.
This is only the carrier, but how do you follow? So you pre-design the carrier. You put the same carrier, you pre-design it. So in the brain, you generate local, you build local oscillators which has the same frequency of the input receptor, input information. I'll tell you in a minute how. This you pre-design, okay? What you don't pre-design is the actual modulation. This could be this one, or it could be a little bit longer, or a little bit shorter. This you don't design, this you decode. What you decode now is the modulation. Okay, what you predetermine is the carrier, what you decode is the modulation. Oh, this, actually.
I'm missing something. You're not decoding it, you just follow it.
No, you generate. Okay, so the target.
It's an error signal.
So the purpose is to generate a local representation of the modulation signal. This is the purpose of the circuit.
But if the two are following each other exactly, then that error signal R just goes to a constant, because it's just a
no. The issue is they follow. If they follow each other exactly, then the modulation signal has to be equal to R prime should be equal to R. Has to be equal to the input modulation signal. The whole story is by trying to follow, by having this error correction. The other way you can think about it is that this guy thinks always that the input will be a constant carrier frequency. Okay? Every time he's being surprised by the input being a little bit different. And by this you get an error signal, which corrects it.
Move on and can you tell us how the error signal is computed? Exactly what is
how is it
computed? You have two spike trains coming in, two X. Right?
Right. Okay. So now the model is simple. You can assume a linear model here, which is which says R. Okay. Equals. This is now a phase detector.
R prime.
Sorry. This is a phase detector. Phase detector is a more natural version of a coincidence detector. So if we said that coincidence detector is an impulse at zero with delta t, the phase detector will have a more natural version, which says as delta t increases, the output decreases, okay, to both sides of zero. So you might say this is, say, R max here, and this is alpha, and we say it's R max minus alpha delta t. I'll show you in a minute how you implement this in with neurons, which is very simple. So if this is
delta t
plus minus. So it's a delta t between t o. It's t o minus.
That's delta big T in the other formula.
On the top, one. No. This is a constant. This is I don't know how to call it. This is a constant. This is not a constant. This is a variable. This is a constant delay of the loop.
What's the definition of delta little t?
It's formula, TO, it's...
Formula.
Okay, all right, I think I'll give you, okay. So it's TI delta t equals ti of n, this is also of n, delta t of n equals ti of n minus to, sorry, to of n minus ti of n. Okay, at every n, every cycle, and the cycle is determined by the appearance of an input spike. Delta t is the difference, is the difference between the timing, the actual timing. Okay, so delta t is in the plot is this one.
Then look at the top, this is exactly what you call delta t.
Delta t, okay.
Delta t is after.
Okay, okay, so, yeah, see what you mean. Okay, delta t equals average of delta t. T-O, let me see if it makes sense, just a second. T-O, okay, so this is what he wrote here. Okay, so you're right. Actually, basically, it's the same. So this is, maybe we should write, this is average TO, false. Okay, so the actual equation is this. This is for averages. So we have a sort of the internal model of the carrier has a certain delay for the input of the carrier because of causality. You cannot actually produce it at the same time.
So is that alpha times absolute value of delta t, or is that alpha times delta t?
Delta t. So this is for every cycle. So I should put here also n, alpha, and this is r prime of n.
In the graph, it looks like alpha times absolute value, or something like that.
Now we take, okay, so we should talk about this. You can forget about this one. Okay. So this is the graph. The implementation implies also this one, but the circuit doesn't work here. This is the working range of the circuit.
Okay, so TO is always greater than TI.
TO is always greater than TI, right. We work on this range. Okay? So this is the working range here. I jump on stages here because in principle, the system could work also here, but we leave it now. We'll talk about the practical implementation that is supported by the data, because this implementation to work in this area is not supported. So we talk about it. So for this implementation, we have these are the equations, and then the equation of the oscillator, we have it is TO of N equals TC plus gamma plus R prime of N. Gamma times R prime of N. So these are actually the equations of the model. Now graphically the other.
So that would be T of N plus 1?
What?
T of N.
Right, N plus 1 should be somewhere. Right. You're perfectly right. Right. That's true.
Right. So the assumption is that the carrier is always slower than the input, and you have to speed it up. The feedback has to be
right. So, it's faster. I mean, it's smaller. The temporal interval is smaller.
T starts out larger.
T, you can only increase it. So.
So I think it's
T is the interval. So you can only increase the interval. In this implementation.
Okay, you can only increase it.
This is plus, this is positive. This is positive factor, okay?
R prime can be positive or negative. R prime is the modulation of
R prime can be positive or negative. Okay, all right. So what we say, you're right. What we say is that in order, since the actual implementation, we jump now a little bit. The actual implementation of the phase detector is a one that produces this function, okay? we don't want, the system doesn't want to be on the edge, because this is a not stable working point. It should be on the range of positive delta t's, okay, which is from here to here, which means that if the modulation is too big, it will tend to take it to the other way around, it will take it out of the stable range. So there are some. This is one of the limitations of the system, which means there is some decodable range. Okay, it will prefer to work somewhere in the middle here, and this will allow a certain modulations. Okay, which are at the maximum. Usually there'll be only half a cycle. So you can demodulate only half a cycle. If the modulation is too big, this circuit will lose it at least for one cycle.
So the radio of the carrier frequency has to be much higher than the modulation frequency.
Yes, in the radio. Yes.
And here.
So in the radio. So this is analogous to the radio, in which we have this is the acoustic signal and this is the carrier signal. But in the radio, this carrier signal is many, many fold times higher. The frequency here is much higher than the frequency of the acoustic signal. So this is up to 10 kilohertz, let's say, and this is 100 megahertz. Okay, so we have no problem it cannot happen that the modulations are always a fraction of pi of the carrier frequency, because this is very slow. Changes here are very slow. Here in the neural case we have a real problem actually, because the modulations, I mean, there is no limitation. I mean, this pi could be very short or very long. And here, I think the solution of the system is to, so every phase-lock loop like this will have a limited working range. So then if you want to cover a large range, you have to keep in parallel phase-lock loops, each having, if we talk about the range of possible input frequencies, let's say in the case of rapidly adapting that we described before, we have it between 10 hertz to 40 hertz, you would keep phase lock loops in all these ranges. If this is F, this is the frequency, well, maybe the most common one will be 30 hertz, but you'll have a parallel code, parallel output from all these PLS, and the system has to choose somehow which PLL with some global feedback mechanism, which PLL is emphasized at a given moment, depending on the velocity of the hand, or vice versa, if it goes out of the range, it can retune the velocity of the hand to take it back, to get it back to the central frequency that is required. So, I'll say it again, the limitation here is a limited working range. The neural input could go beyond this working range, thus we need a bank of these phase-lock loops, and the input can be controlled by a global feedback, which now will take this output, so some velocity controller.
Are you done with PLL? Because I need to understand how much.
No, we can copy this. I can copy this, yeah, no problem.
I have just one question. I mean, your view is very different from the textbook position. Normally, when it talks about phase lock loops, when it talks about averaging over many cycles, it's back to sort of Mary's question. Right? You average over many cycles, so you beat down, you know, multiples of the carrier, etc. But here you're talking about something which is just operating on a feedback on the time scale of the carrier, on all time scales, on the carrier of the frequency.
What you're saying, a phase lock loop takes time for the feedback loop to converge. It takes many cycles.
Right.
For the feedback loop.
Oh, this is a parameter of the loop, David. This is a parameter of the loop which says it depends on the open loop gain. So you have open loop gain is if you open the loop here and you compute the gain along the loop. Okay. In this case, it will be alpha times gamma. Okay, just the gains of the two loops. We call it beta. And it depends on beta. In this case, if beta, the stable range is for beta to be between 0 to minus 2.
Wait,
No, and the velocity and the lock-in speed. How many cycles it will take it to lock in depends on the value here. If it's minus one, it will take only one cycle. But also in the radio, it's the same issue.
But you're not adding any, there's no integrator in this model. It's just a straight multiplication.
Right.
There's no integrator.
Right.
So.
Okay, in the radio, let me rephrase what David says. In the radio, you have here low-pass filter. One of the reasons to have low-pass filter is because the multiplier here produces also high frequencies. You have to remove them. We don't have it in the neural implementation, so we don't need it, basically.
By hand, you put in a relationship that says you don't have it. So
okay, so let me show you the implementation. How you produce it, this is very simple. Just to show you this, this is very simple. How do you make this phase detector? Okay, phase detector is a very natural feature of neurons, and it goes as this. If you have a single neuron, which receives two massive inputs. What do we mean by massive? If this is the resting potential, and this is the firing threshold, every input is larger than half, but smaller than the distance to the threshold. If they coincide, okay, they'll cross the threshold. If they're a little bit delayed, okay, they will still cross the threshold with less and less probability until it goes down. And it goes both ways. So you could say, and this is a known, by the way, known feature of thalamic neurons. Okay? So you have a burst coming from the brainstem, for example. You have a burst coming from the cortex to the thalamus. The output of the thalamus will be only in the overlapping period of the two. So now you can see that if you shift, okay, if you shift these things around relative to the timing here, what you get is less and less spikes in both directions, okay, as a function of delta t. Between the two offsets. Two onsets, sorry. This is delta t. Okay, so this implementation can be done by any cell which receives two strong inputs, but which are not strong enough. And this is called as N-gating by the N-gating.
Why are there so many spikes now?
You have a burst coming from here, from the brainstem, so to speak, and from the...
But it'll actually work with one spike, the way you've drawn it, because you're
yes.
in the cell.
Yes, it can work with... Oh, one. Why we have many from here to here?
Yeah, one or two spikes, now you have lots of spikes.
Okay. Okay, so the story, the transformation from one to many has several phases. In the tactile case, where you have only one, what you have is you have some 20 or 30 fibers overlapping on this point, leading to the thalamus, and you have some uniform distribution of conduction velocities, and it's a long way to run. So at the end, when they come as a population, they come to activate single sense in the thalamus, all of them, you have a spread of spikes. So this is a population spike. In the Vibrissa case, where it's lower frequencies, you actually have this burst in the input. The input is not a single spike, but you have a burst in the input. So in any case, if you think about this massive input, the thalamic neuron is burst. It's never a single spike.
It's cortex,
right? And the cortex feedback, so also this is a little bit less known, but you know that the neurons in layer 5 that project back to the thalamus are bursters. Oh, they dominate the projections. Our bursters, what? Each one of them is a burster, and you have a population, and you have NMDA receptors in the thalamus. All of these elements elongate the effective input to the thalamus. So it's never a point stimulus in time. It always has a time constant. And it's on the order, depending on the system, but between 30 to 100 milliseconds, depending on the system. So you have in the thalamus, and it's not only in thalamus, but in thalamus, the two inputs are elongated inputs, and the interval in time between them will determine the amount of output in basically in this way. What? Depending on what condition. In layer 5 in the slice. Okay, even so, I'm not sure what will be the case. Even so, you have tree, you have a population of such things, and you have the NMDA receptors here. All of these factors effectively will produce some.
Even if you don't think about multiple spikes, if you think about this probabilistically, so you can have single spikes in your two inputs, and you can be applying probability of firing versus delta T.
Yes. It works. But I prefer. Yes, but the operation of the loop should be valid for every cycle. So it's true what you say, but I think the population, the amount of fibers that actually arrive here, translate this probability to actual firing. So it'll have actually number of spikes for.
Is this a break time? Yeah, great break time.
Great
break time. All right, so why don't we just come back at
11?
11.
Okay.
Give us a finger break.
Need to drink some water.
So that's
yeah, I should know that I should prepare these equations exactly, but we can work it out.
It's discrete in the sense it's determined for every cycle. So depending how we determine the
cycle.
It's constant.
No, it's a spike trend.
It's just a number.
TI is
no, wait. If you talk about the equations, it's a number. But the implementation, it will be a population spike.
No, in this equation, the only define the discrete number. So it's like the same spike trend as TI. It's the same.
No. TI is in time. So you have the difference is, this is a temporal parameter. This is the units here in milliseconds. This is in milliseconds.
This is spike intervals.
Right. And the units here are in spikes. Number of spikes. Per cycle.
But how do you add G0 is also in interspike
intervals?
Yes,
in the line. G0 is. Now this is a translator, right. This is a translator and this is a translator.
So gamma is one of the alpha.
In units, yes. In units, they're the opposite of the other. So this is spikes per cycle divided by milliseconds.
Okay, R prime is the opposite. It's a little bit of the time. It's some other.
R prime is this number and spikes per cycle. Okay, the basic element here is a cycle.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Are you still using the projector?
Yes.
For another hour or so? I don't know what to do, John.
Okay, so this is the input, and you want R to be.
Okay.
So what is the desired output?
The desired output is the translation of this tempo. So information here is in time.
Okay.
29 or 30.
Okay, TR.
And I want this translated to spikes per second. So this is.
Okay, so this should be a linear function. But so why it jumps here when there are no...
So what I say, let me see how I figure it out. What I did is going by the internal. So it changes here. The timing of change is in here.
So it should jump with a sub delay of the original spike.
Right.
Each delay.
Now the delay is determined by the
system. Okay, come out of the model. You don't say that that's what you want.
Right.
Okay, so that's what you want. If this is what you are given. This is the problem, this is the answer.
This is the answer, yes.
Okay, and you say, I have to solve this equation that this will give me R prime only of M.
Yes.
R prime should be a function,
of n. So it doesn't change within the cycle. Yeah.
Ah, okay, okay.
Of n, every
okay,
cycle.
You give it n is immediately after this part of the vector.
Right.
Okay.
So when I produce this phi, it means I have the answer here, the firing output.
So this is Ti, and R should be a little bit shifted,
right.
And every time immediately after this phi, it tells me the next it was particular.
Yes, after this phi.
After this.
Because then it computes the
vector. So R prime should tell me where the next phi will be.
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Okay, so this is a little. Now, TC, how do I know what TC is?
Give me parameter.
No.
So TC, the input is given, but TC. Okay, so how we compute it?
So this is a sort of a virtual variable,
which is we computed, we have two ways. One is to wait to the end of an epoch. It's for us, it's not for the brain. Okay, I'll tell you how the brain is. For us, we take that epoch, compute the average temporal interval, and this would be TC.
But you say this should work also if delta T changes over time.
Yes, it works also.
Ah, so
this TC is just a way to put, just a way to describe things.
Okay, so it's an average spike.
Average.
Somehow you have to know that.
Yes, the brain, what it will do, it will take the local filter of this.
Yeah, but what does it feel about mathematics? The brain is
So
the input is actually two things, the spike rate and this number. Somehow you have to know also the average number of spikes, or just the total number of spikes. You just need.
Okay, so Ti equals TC plus
But I want to understand what you do.
It's two numbers.
So this
TI
is
TI plus TC.
And one number, that's your input. Now you have to plug it in here. And you see this is an equation which can will allow me to compute out loud. So how do I solve this equation? So let's say I tell you Ti and Tc.
Okay, you can solve it for
gamma and alpha are given. Okay. One
is for the
last question.
That's Rm.
Just
Rm is this value.
Oh,
this is a function of delta t. This is a delta Rm of n. It's a number.
Rm is a number in this range.
Okay, just a number. This is a parameter of the number.
Right.
But this is also a fixed parameter, isn't it? I mean, you need for every particular phase law, every particular carrier frequency, you need a particular phase law. Right?
Yes.
Like in a radio where you have to choose the frequency, right?
Right. This is the station. Okay, so this is the station in the radio, but it is true. But there is a trick. Okay, maybe it can go about it. With the global feedback, you can tune this adaptively. Right now it's an input.
Okay. So these two inputs.
So your question is,
you say you have out of this, you have to find R prime for every input.
Yes. Now you have in the steady state. The question is, how do you solve? Can you solve
this equation? I give you this two. You have to tell me R prime. I don't see how mathematically you do it. This should contain all the information which, given this and this, should provide you this. Okay.
Then you just
So how? What would be the procedure? Numerical. Let's say I want to do it in the computer.
Numerical.
I give you a set of numbers and I give you this number. How would I? You have to iterate somehow. You should be aware of iterating it. And taking out this alpha.
Yes.
The code, simple code.
Yes. But you assume that TC of TO is the same, right?
Yeah.
You assume that
should
TC
I
prime.
Look somewhere else so I can only look. No, but that's
okay. This should be enough.
Because here there is the same equation with TC prime. So I guess this should be actual TC.
Just put them the same.
Okay, so we don't need this. So all we need is this color.
Right.
Okay.
So what's
later?
So here you go from n to n plus 1.
Right. Okay, so you know that, so you have at every given moment, every n, you have ti and to?
No, I don't know what's to. This is the difference. What's to? How do I compute to?
Okay, to is, this is an intrinsic oscillator, so it works by itself, and you have a to defined for every cycle.
It fires. Okay, it's from the last cycle. From the last cycle, we have an R prime, okay? We have a gamma, and we have TC. So we get T over
the last.
You start at N, okay?
N equals 1.
Okay, let's say N equals 1.
Yes.
Then you get a TO for N equals 2. Okay, now you use this with
okay,
N equals
from
2.
R, this I know, and yeah. Let's say I know this.
Yeah, you know
I
this?
Find next.
This 2. Two. So you go to 2.
Then you go to here, I find next. This
for 2,
three.
And then you get delta 3, and then you're
there. And then you okay, so that's how I do.
Okay, I get it. I
understand. So this is from the so this will not be an oscillator. It's not an oscillator because it will have G0 will change over time.
This is a controlled oscillator, what we call it.
Yeah, but it will not fire period.
No. It will have some period, but will be modulated along the period.
But then isn't it when you that opportunity count of that's the fact that the לא, אתה אומר, המשוואה הזאת, היא לוקחת דלתא T, היא מרשבת R prime, אז אתה כאילו מרשה לעצמך לתרגל דלתא T ל-R
prime. כן, אבל
הדלתא T... אבל אתה לא יכול לעשות את זה על דלתא T המקורי, ולא על דלתא T האלה, שזה אנושי.
איך הייתי יכול לעשות את זה? אני לא יכול, דלתא T הזה, המשוואה הזאת היא לא לדלתא T מאותו ספייטרי. משני אינפוטים שונים.
אני יודע, אבל אני עושה עותק.
אוקיי, אני עושה עותק, זה מה שאני עושה. אני בעצם עושה עותק דיליי בזמן, דיליי בסייקל אחד. אני עושה אותו פה. ואז אני משווה את הסייקל N וסייקל N פלוס אחד. כי זה עותק, TO זה עותק של הסייקל הקודם.
אז זה בעצם מה
שאתה עושה. כן, זה בעצם. אתה עושה עותק, אתה שיפטן. אני מייצר עותק של הסייקל הקודם, ואז מה שאתה עושה, כאילו עושה מגזרת של השיעות השינוי בדלתא.
אבל R prime, למה ש-R prime באמת לא עושה? אתה לא, כאילו, עכשיו אני מבין מה אתה עושה.
כן. עכשיו, למה R prime יהיה שווה R?
למה זה יהיה מה שאתה עושה?
בגלל שזה שווה לזה.
מה קורה?
בגלל ש...
זה אותה משמעות,
למה? למה אני הולך לשם?
זה,
TI. עכשיו למה שווה TI? TI שווה ל-TC פלוס גמא R.
זה הגדרה.
ככה הגדרתי את האינפוט.
לא. R,
זה R פריים.
בסדר, אז למה R prime?
אז אני אומר, אם TO שווה ל-TI, בסייקל הקודם, הכל בדילי של סייקל. אז זה לא קיים פה, אוקיי.
הוא לא שווה ל-TI.
לא, אוקיי, אז באמת, TO, זה צריך להוסיף את זה, של TO,
זה לא, זה מספיק כדי לפתור את זה, למה שאפשר עוד סתם לפתור את
זה?
לא,
זה יוצא מזה, תן לי רגע לחשוב איך אני מנסה.
אתה אומר ש...
אני אומר, למה זה שווה, אוקיי, יש שני דרכים בעצם להראות למה R' שווה ל-R, זה מה שאנחנו רוצים להראות. דרך אחת זה דרך אחת אמרנו, מה שאמרנו קודם, זה עותק TO, TO של N פלוס 1, יש שווה ל-TI של N.
זה תלוי בדלתא T, דלתא של תלוי באלפא בכלל, יש עוד פרמטרים. תראו, אתה לא בביקור, אתה כאילו פותר את זה, אבל אתה מקבל איזה שם, תראו, למה שזה מוצא את זה.
אוקיי, מה ש... אוקיי, בסדר. מה שיוצא לנו, צריך לעבוד לך על זה, מה שיוצא כשבטא שווה למינוס 1,
כשאלפא
כפול גמא שווה למינוס 1, או בעצם אם השוואה הזאת שווה לפלוס 1, אני שם פה את המספור, כשזה שווה לפלוס 1, זה יוצא. זה אני יכול לעבוד.
אוקיי, אלפא צריך לתת.
כן, זה אני יכול לעבוד. כשזה שווה ל...
אוקיי, זה לא עוד פרמטר.
לא, זה יוצא מתוך זה. יוצא מתוך זה, כן, וזה אפשר להראות. בוא נעזוב את זה רגע, אני אראה לך.
בסדר, אוקיי, לא צריך.
ואז זה יוצא, ואז יוצא נכון. אוקיי, ואז זה מתקיים.
זה צריך להיות
אחת כותי גם. לא חייב. כשזה יוצא, אז יוצא פר סייקל. אם הוא לא, אם הוא בתוך הטווח הזה, אבל אני אגיד 1.5. חצי. זה לא יהיה נכון, זה יהיה אפרוקסימי. וזה אינך מתכנס, יהיה קונברג'ן.
לא, לא, what you say is fine, you can solve it, but why this gives you the desired output?
Why this gives you the fixed point? Yeah, that's a
good question. No, why does it give you the R which you want?
Yeah.
You didn't show it yet.
We didn't show it yet.
No. Now we know that this is a question which you can solve.
Okay. Now, what I'm saying is the following. When in the condition, this will not be strictly true for every condition, it will be strictly true only for the condition in which alpha times gamma equal 1.
So if alpha equals 1 over gamma,
right.
You solve this and you, so this you say you can show somehow that R prime will be exactly this R right. Which is given. Well, I think it's enough. I want to see how it comes out.
Okay, we can write it out.
It's a system of which makes a prediction, right?
Yes.
I mean, it cannot really know where this value is. It could change. In the real value of R could change. So you just see, you have a cycle. So right. The next one comes too early. Therefore, the next one must be longer.
No.
But it's a prediction. It could be otherwise.
No, it was not.
It will be.
It can be wrong.
So it cannot be.
It can only be true if this is really.
What happens is this is. Now
R
prime.
Much better what R prime is.
R prime is it with delay of one n, one cycle.
Okay.
So what you have.
It's not exactly R. It will be R delay.
R delay.
Yes.
What you have is you have this one now here.
This is this one.
Yes, you have this is all the all this cycle is shifted. All this modulation signal is shifted to the right with R prime. This is so R prime of n plus 1 equal
R of R.
In the next cycle, it will be equal to this cycle.
Okay, so I have a full book. You say this is what will be.
So you need now this to show this, right? Mm-hmm.
And
this.
Then you say if it's not exactly one, it will be.
It will converge, yes. Then if it's not exactly one, it cannot follow it cycle by cycle. It will take 2-3 cycles to converge. And then it limits you again by the rate of modulation.
But it means that if I give you as an input the spike trend, which is not periodic, just
it's periodic. Not periodic.
No, this is periodic.
Oh, okay.
But let's say I give you unpredictable data.
Then you get here.
So for alpha gamma equals 1, it will still can follow exactly every delta t. And if not, it will do wrong.
Yes. given the delta t
is not average, but it's no longer TC is just a spike count, just an overall spike count. So it should be chosen correctly. Because if you
if you make a mistake here, what you'll get here is all this will be shifted up or down. You'll have a DC. If you make a mistake here, you'll have a DC component added to this.
This is the
You can write this plus arrow plus DC arrow, you know. And this plus this should be
the correct one.
So if you miss it here.
Maybe a lot of human.
It's a constant term like TC, so it just.
No, but let's say I take not the real TC, okay. But some wrong.
So you can write here, you take this will equal to T prime C plus all this. This will be.
Do you need to have TC specified?
This is an input. This is part of
our.
Somebody has to tell you, somebody has to measure.
But if it can be the constant piece of R,
it can be
constant piece of R.
So if you say there's an error, there's going to be an error piece in TC.
Yes.
Which would introduce a bias on R.
Yes. Right.
Right. Could all of TC just be accounted for as bias?
I think my friend might come down.
In other words, would it train itself up?
And if the basic what's the meaning of picking up the wrong TC is you choose out the wrong oscillator. Instead of 30, you take the 25 one. So the 25 one will have the same modulation signal, but just shifted.
Right.
So you have a population of these oscillators. One of them will be exactly, and the rest will have this shift.
So TC is not, it's not that critical that it's.
It's not that critical, it'll be exactly. It should be in the range. What it will do, it will, if this is wrong, it can cause the phase of loop to work here, and it will be closer to saturation. Then it will screw up these delta t's. But this is only part of it. I'll just take water.
I think you put the green non-linearity here, it takes us to the magnitude of that.
קצת חשמל, כאילו, מעגל של פידבק שקורע, שקורע סינכרוניזציה, משהו כזה. אני אלך נשאר אותך.
Just
pick, yeah, if you know how to
very good because you will pay for my problem.
Very complicated logical definition.
The radio experiment could be done, it's not the radio experiment, it's not the radio experiment.
Okay, let's walk.
So, as I discussed with Misha in the break, these equations are enough to solve the loop, and so it goes. Let me summarize it. It goes that we, given Ti and Tc as an input, we can at every step we have the modulation function for a given step, given a time step, we can compute the TO. The modulation function compute the next cycle, next timing of the oscillator, as you know, from which we can compute delta T between the oscillator timing and the input timing. And this delta T reveals the Rn for the next cycle. Now the question is how do I show that R prime equals R, which is the purpose of this circuit? So the answer is that R prime of the next cycle will be equal to R of the previous cycle, to the input modulation of the previous of the current cycle, if gamma times alpha times gamma, the open loop gain of the circuit equals one. If it equals one, you can work out the equation. It gives you that R prime of the next cycle equals R of the.
That was minus one, no?
Or R prime of n equals R of n minus one. So the R prime of the current cycle equals the input modulation of the previous cycle.
But the open loop gain has to be exactly one?
Exactly one for this to happen at every given cycle, in one cycle. If it's not exactly one, it will converge. It will be roughly equal, depending on the distance from one, and it will take a few cycles for it.
I'm completely confused. If I know Tc, and you give me Ti, why don't I just take the difference, divide by gamma, and I have R of n? Is gamma the equation up with the second equation on the right column? No, the second very on top. Ti equals Tc plus gamma R. If I know Tc and you give me Ti, I just take the difference Ti minus Tc and divide by gamma. I know R.
But
Tc
you don't know.
Tc you have to
Tc.
Basically, this is what you do. Okay, you have Tc here but modulated. How do you take the difference between Ti and Tc? How do you do it?
I think just it's an implementation.
Yes, the implementation is that you produce a replica of the input here, but delayed in time. So it is as if you compare the current cycle of the input to its previous cycle. This is how it works.
So the other question I have has to do with noise in the internet. Because when alpha is 1 or just below 1, you're converging quickly. So suppose you have extra spikes. Suppose instead of having a perfect spike train, you actually have a spike train that with the variable nature of a spike train as the input, right? And then, in fact, this extra spike could push you into the unstable region of your operating system. So, I mean, because of that, you need to operate with alpha small in order to
Extra spike will not affect, say, if you have, say you're talking about extra spike here.
Or on the input, on Ti. Suppose Ti.
On Ti, it will not make a difference. Itself because you compute delta t between the onsets. But actually, so if you talk about the implementation here, right, you talk about if you have extra spike here, that will propagate to the output. Otherwise, it's meaningless if it's here or here or here. So if it's here and it propagates, then it will affect.
Yeah, of course.
It's a question of the accuracy of this system. So the noise, if the noise will be big enough to take you out of this range, well, see, if R goes up, it cannot if R goes beyond R, you have a saturation effect. You cannot drive this to the reverse direction. So you drive the oscillator to its intrinsic frequency. And then, of course, you're not stable. So if you have an error, too big error, you drive the system to an unstable region. From which it will recover, but it will take 2 or 3 cycles to recover.
No, but if alpha is 1, it won't take 1 cycle. I'm trying to get a sense
of
the noise bandwidth.
If beta is 1, if the multiplication is 1, this will be true. This will be equal. You'll have exactly the temporal pattern here, and you will have exactly this one. This equation, equality. Okay. If it's close to 1, you'll have it close. That's the same amount.
So why don't you take the input spike trend and feed it directly into this estimator of R versus delta Q? Because it doesn't seem to make any difference if the spikes come from the same spike trend or from two different spike trends.
No, you want to estimate this, right? The period here.
Yes.
If you take the same spike trend,
yeah.
And feed it well here,
So you can translate delta T into R's by doing some procedure, right? You say you know how to.
This is the procedure. But the procedure requires using delta T.
So you don't have delta T from your
spot. No, this is different delta T. This is the period. This is the input. This is TI. This is TI. Delta T is between.
So why does it differ that it should be between different spike trends and not with?
If you take the same spike where you feed it into this device, it will always overlap. Always overlap. If you take the same one. Unless you feed it through a delay line, as we described before, you could do it.
So the point is that you can only use very short delays.
Yes,
very short ones. And here you want to estimate.
Right. Shorter than the period.
And here And here you want to estimate periods which are far longer than your AND gate can do. That's the point. Yes. Otherwise, you could just directly take it.
No, you cannot because it's the same signal. It's the signal. I mean, this is the input. This is TI. Right? If you just feed it twice to the end gate, you get the same thing output. That's the output. You don't. It doesn't compute. This is the difference between, say, period and phase. It doesn't compute. We have. Maybe the confusion is by the transition from a single spike to another. This is now our period. TI of N. This is TI of this one. We want to compute this. Now, if I just take this and feed it to the end, and the end correlator here, I'll just get a replica of the same signal. Not get any translation. Okay? I have to convert this interval. I want to convert this interval, to a time frame. So by feeding it, it will not happen. I could delay it. I could delay the one by this amount, then feed it.
But that's like back to
this. Yeah, something like this. Or I can produce an internal replica of it and then compare it.
So internal replica will be just shifted.
Shifted in time. Okay. And then I play on this delta T. This is an internal variable.
But delta T will be the same. It's just.
No, this is
T. Forget about the burst. First new feature which will not.
What?
No birds.
Okay, maybe it's just move on.
Let me just details aside, just make sure I understand conceptually what's going on there. In the limit that alpha is close to 1, this device functions to make up. It's a memory device. You're remembering what the input looks like at the n minus first cycle, and it's a way to compare the nth input to the n minus first. It's operating as a memory element with one period.
Yeah, this is a memory element of one period. Exactly.
Okay, that's the key.
And that was
That was sort of always my confusion. You know, we talked about phase off loops, we talked about a very long number of periods into the past.
Right, in the radio. Right. In the radio, is the principle is similar, but implementation is similar. Okay, let's go to the experiment, the predictions. Predictions and experimental results. The main prediction is here, of this loop. I mean, the main. So if you think about these three kinds, the delay line and the open loop and the closed loop.
There should be another spike term, which is just a copy of. So the first prediction is that you should find two spike traits, okay, which are just copies of each other.
Right. The first prediction is that we have such oscillators in the brain, which replicate, which are locked into the. So they might have their own frequency, but once you stimulate with some frequency, they lock to this frequency.
Not just they replicate the spike trait by shift by one,
right,
one into
right,
spike.
That's true. This is the first prediction. But this could happen also with the open loop oscillators. They should also lock because of the risk population. Okay. The thing that should not occur with the open loop oscillators is this inverse relationship of R and delta T. Okay, there is one more step that
means rate and delta T.
Rate and delta T.
But what do you mean by that?
So this is a prediction of the closed loop model that you have these two variables interrelated in inverse fashion that produce this negative feedback. And it's not predicted by the open loop. There's no requirement for such a relationship between the output and delta T. What is delta T here?
It's two steps. The guys that produce whose rate varies inversely, delta T is one population of cells,
right,
and the oscillators are a second population of cells.
Okay.
You should find two cell types. That's the prediction.
Right. You should have two cell types. Now you should have another thing. The other thing is that what you can work out, and maybe we'll make it short this time, is that as a function of frequency, you should delta T should increase with the frequency, and R should decrease with the frequency of the input. The average R should decrease with increasing frequency, and delta T should increase with increasing frequency. Okay, it's simple to show, but let's go to the results. It's just outcome.
Delta T is just the interspike interval, essentially.
No, delta T now here is the frequency.
But this is the copy, so you become...
Copy, but it has some frequency. Shifted, not by a fixed amount. It shifted on the average, it has a set point here, but the set point here depends on the frequency, it will shift. So up and down.
Look at these two equations. You have delta T of L, one equation, and the one on the bottom. At the bottom, the very bottom.
Right.
So doesn't it tell you that delta T is just an interspike interval of the spike, the input spike T?
No. No, delta T is defined here.
T zero of L is the same as Ti of L minus 1, according to the bottom. Mm-hmm. So if you plug it in, this will be just
okay. There is a latency issue here.
So there is another delta T.
T O M plus 1.
Well, somewhere N, it should be minus 1 first of all.
No, plus
1
and
N.
That's another.
Could be
minus 1. T O. That's delta T.
So there is another delta T.
That's delta T. Of N, so the fixed point has always a delta T. What? Yeah, the fixed point you have a delta T.
The final delta T of the fixed point, which is
right. Oh, okay, a delta T of the fixed point.
Okay.
Right.
So it's a replica shifted by.
Shifted by
interval plus something else.
Right.
Plus this. Yes. And this is determined here, and this depends on the frequency. Okay, so the prediction, so this is the prediction that is not, it's specific to the closed loop, and it's not predicted by the open loop because there's nothing there that will make the dependencies of these guys on frequency. It's open loop.
So why is it drawn with the F?
Why is it drawn with
the F? It comes out. Okay.
It comes out. It's simple. It comes out. Okay, so this is what we learned to test. And where are we? So the first step, as you said, the first step was to see whether we have these oscillators in the brain. And we tested it in behaving monkeys, somatosensory cortex. And we saw this is a matrix of autocorrelations, of four single units, autocorrelations and cross-correlations. And you see that in this case, there are three or maybe even four units that oscillate. So the oscillations are reduced by these fluctuations in the autocorrelation. And this is some 100 milliseconds, so this is about 30 hertz. And they are independent. They don't correlate, the oscillations do not correlate with each other.
Is that correlogram?
These are correlograms. Autocorrelograms and cross-correlograms of the fire.
And the central peak is removed.
Okay, so these are the oscillators. Second requirement of both open loop and closed loop is that the distribution of frequencies of these oscillators will match the input frequency. Okay? So in the monkey and human, rapidly adapting, actually the total sum of all kind of receptors generates some two or three modal picture if you calculate the number of receptors that are sensitive to a particular frequency. And the distribution of oscillations in the cortex roughly match this three modal distribution, which corresponds to the three types of receptors. Now in the monkey, what we saw is that when we stimulate, in the monkey, we were not prepared, actually, we made auditory experiments, but then we found these oscillators, which evoked all this model. And then we tested just the effect of just stimulation, sweeping things aperiodically on the fingertip. And what we saw is the effect was to remove the oscillation. So if a cell was oscillating, it stopped oscillating when we just stimulated it with aperiodic stimulation.
These are awake times, right?
This is awake monkeys. So after we had these findings, actually we developed these ideas, which we took from electrical engineering. And then it made sense that if these oscillators indeed try to follow these aperiodic stimulations, they will stop the periodic because they
input.
Okay, so in this experiment, we couldn't determine it, and then I looked for the best system to...
Wait, I'm sorry. In that system, they didn't follow it. I mean,
no. I don't know if they followed or not. We didn't have the equipment to actually make computer control stimulation. We just try hand strikes on the receptive fields with brushes and things like this.
No, but if the cell naturally just qualitatively, if the cell naturally fired at a certain frequency before you stimulate,
yes,
and then you stimulated at a different frequency.
Well, we didn't try. No, we didn't have the idea of this model when we had these results.
All right, next thing you have a hard time, just trying to see what was known.
What?
And not trying to give you a hard time. But then after you stopped stimulating, so the cell was oscillating and you were stimulating with a brush, and then you stopped. Did it stop the fire again, and it's the same
thing? Again with the, this is actually here, this is sequential events. So spontaneous activity, two oscillators occurred together. One stimulation, I don't remember, to one of the fingers, which was effective for one of them, but not for the other. Then we go back to the spontaneous activity, then we stimulate a different receptive field, which was combined, both stopped, and then again, they went back to the same frequency.
But what happens if you stimulate periodically with a different frequency?
I'll show you. So, then actually, the monkey, the heavy monkey, is not the best preparation to do this
exact studies. And what we did is we went to the rodent. So in the monkey and primate thing, you get this periodicity when you move your fingers across gratings, and it depends on the velocity of the movement, etc. In the rodent case, when you look at its behavior, what you see is that it moves the whiskers pretty rapidly here. To appreciate the movement, we have to go to a slow movement. Slow down movement, which is this one. And you can see that it moves the whiskers back and forth. It moves the head to a position and then moves the whiskers back and forth. And this movement is very periodic. People study this periodicity, and it turns out to be pretty much periodic, although the frequency fluctuates. But for a given epoch, it is periodic. If it rains, the rat to keep its head underneath this photo beam here and to try to localize this pole. Again, it moves the whiskers back and forth, okay, with a more or less periodic.
What are you doing?
So you train it to hold the face here, and it has to compare the position of this pole to another pole, which is in the other side. You know, but in this case, we have only one. And now, if you close zoom on the interaction between the whisker and the pole, you see something like this. This is very much slowed down. So it goes and hit the obstacle, it's bent a little bit, and then continues.
This is a fog with two hairs in it, that's not some artifact.
Some of the hairs, no, it's two hairs with a very from the same follicle. So continuously there's one growing up to replace the old one, but sometimes you get them both.
Are you just taking a same trial running in circles?
Yes.
So when you actually look at these, do you see her tap once, or do you see her go back and forth a couple of times? This implication from the model is that you see a couple of times.
Okay, this we don't have with this behavioral things, we were able to take the video shots, but not yet reasonable conclusions from behavioral direct. So it will take another opportunity. So we have this very stereotypic one, and the other advantage of the rat is that the circuitry is very, very well worked out, unlike in the monkey. What you see here is the pathway from the whiskers to the cortex, which goes through two stations, brainstem and thalamus, and along two pathways. One is the lemniscus, one is the paralemniscus. And they are separate, the two. Now, much is known about the lemniscal one. Very little is known about the paralemniscal system. And what we did to start to look for these predictions is to record in the cortex of these whiskers while moving the whiskers. So we anesthetize them, and we move the whiskers periodically. So we control the movement of the whisker. And what you see here is, again, these oscillators in the cortex of the rat. And this is the distribution of frequencies. And you see that they cluster around 1 hertz, 10 hertz, and roughly 100 hertz. And the 10 hertz are those that are relevant for whisking, because this is the frequency of whisking. So immediately you see that these oscillators in the red have different frequency, and the frequency makes sense with regard to the sensory input, which is the right 10 hertz. Now to test if these oscillators can be tuned locally, what we did is we applied glutamate locally to these neurons just to excite them. And we saw that if this is the pre-glutamate oscillation frequency, this is auto correlation, it can double if you apply glutamate, then it increases even more. If you apply more glutamate, then roughly these are the modulation function of glutamate. So if you excite these neurons, they increase the frequency. This is a requirement for these local oscillators to be able to tune.
You just want to establish that it's monotonic.
What?
The key thing is to establish, except for that one example, they're all monotonic. That's the critical thing you're trying to establish. Is that if you excite them, the frequency goes up. It doesn't matter if it's linear.
They are monotonic, except for one, right? This is the key point. They should be monotonic, not necessarily linear. But this is not so accurate experiment because the two glutamate in the vicinity will excite many cells, including inhibitory cells. But basically, it's good. Okay, now the first key prediction, which is it should follow an input, this oscillator should follow an input periodicity. So if you take now, instead of the autocorrelation, just the interval histogram, okay, so only the interval to the first order interval histogram, spontaneously this neuron oscillates around this is about 6 hertz or so. This is 150 milliseconds. Now if we stimulate it with 5 hertz, in this case, you can see that on the average, the TC, so to speak, the carrier frequency of this neuron shifts towards the 5 hertz. Then we leave it, it stays somewhere in the middle, then we stimulate at 8 hertz, and it goes to the 8 hertz. So this is 125 milliseconds.
Your stimulation is moving the whisker.
Moving the whisker.
But when you leave it, it stays at the same frequency as it was before.
Right, like in the middle, I don't know, but yes.
Also in the end?
Yes, yes. So it's sort of long-lasting, sort of plastic effects. Like, it's an adaptive system, so, right. It's better than the radio in this case. If you move from
NPR
to the other station, it will let
it. But actually, it's exactly like the modern radio phase-lock loops. Charge pump scheme. They remember the last frequency.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yes. There is now in modern phase of loops, electronic ones, they do things like this. You know. Okay, now about the first prediction. So the next prediction is that, let me show you. So this is on the average, and now cycle by cycle, you can see the picture here. The red rectangles here are the on this axis we have time, on this axis we have the inter-spike interval, or inter-stimulus interval. So the interval between successive stimuli, like this is our peak, our TI, sorry. So this is this TI, okay. Now it's fixed because we move it in the constant carrier frequency. And this is the red rectangles. Okay, so every red rectangle is a movement, and its position along the y-axis is that this is the interval in time from the previous movement of the disk. Now the blue ones are the inter-spike intervals of this oscillator. And what we see is that we have some fluctuations, but once we start stimulation, it has some lock-in period. So it goes below higher frequency, lower frequency, and then it locks. In this case, it locks. this is the 5 hertz case. This is the 8 hertz case. It is locked. It stays locked after the stimulus finished, and then it goes away. Now, while locking, we measure the delta T between the two. So the blue one lags a little bit. The onset of the rectangle here, as you can see. And we measure the latency from here to here and plot it as the wrinkle here. So the latency stabilizes also when the frequency stabilizes, the latency stabilizes. And the important thing to see is that the latency with the 8 hertz is longer than the latency with the 5 hertz. Okay, now this is a prediction of the closed loop. This is this prediction. And it is not predicted by the open loop because there's nothing in the open loop that will require this or induce this.
So if you stimulate it periodically, it will also follow every loop. Because this is like a clock, so if you have
a clock,
so the same frequency, of course, they are locked by you have
no, but it has to tune the frequency. You see, the frequency is not exactly.
But after you load it, they tune the frequency.
After you load, they have to have.
They have to be loaded.
Yes. We did the yes, we did later on actually the modulated frequency. Yes. But the basic thing from here is the steady state. This is steady state. Okay, we just keep the same frequency. And it's a set point. So it's a shift of the set point here according to different frequencies. And we see that the latency that is associated with the higher frequency is higher. Okay, this is the thing from.
So that you say that's strong evidence because it's against sort of a naive view of locking, which should be, if anything, less time. Like if I took a neuron, like
With a higher frequency.
So these type 1 neurons that are only positive sensitivity functions, and so the neuron is most sensitive to its input, sort of not exactly right before, but just before its action potential. So then you would have said that as I go to higher frequencies, in fact, the timing would have gotten shorter, right? Because the whole curve is compressed. So the fact that this is opposite the single cell locking dependence is strong evidence for some sort of network or some feedback.
But when we look at the population of cells in the cortex, when we didn't pay attention to the layer so much, and we recall it from oscillating neurons and non-oscillating neurons. So this one was from, I think, layer 5, that one that I showed you. But we had in this experiment, we just take the layer information by the depth of the recording. We didn't make lesions, etc., because we didn't realize that it's so important. I'll show you next. And we saw two families of neurons. Those that now, if you look at the dependency on frequency, so this is steady state frequencies. We increase that, and we look at the latency of the oscillatory neurons. On the average, most of them increase the frequency. There were here 13 neurons, 13 oscillators. 9 of them did increase the frequency increase the latency, delta t, with the frequency. But 4 of them did not. So some of them did, some of them did not.
But that's also strong evidence. I mean, by the same token, you would expect the curves going the opposite direction for the naive model. So it's, both curves seem strong evidence for some kind of feedback circuit.
The flat one?
Yeah, even the flat one.
I'm not sure how much would be the negative slope should be. It might be very small.
Right. The whole curve gets compressed, right? The whole limit cycle gets compressed. So in fact, you change the frequency there by huge amounts.
No, but you could still have the fall delay because of the conduction through the layer. Through the brainstem, thalamus, etc., you have it. And then only. So anyway, we saw these two families, and then
it's a rare moment. We tried to be nice.
So this is consistent with the model. The other one, we're not sure. It's not consistent. It's not as predicted by the model. And the same we saw when we now this is these are the oscillators. In this study, we try to see the input layer from the thalamus, like in layer 4 and 5, which are the input layers. And again, we saw the non-oscillating neurons. Again, we saw the two families of those that show dependency of the latency and those that do not show the dependency. So then we figure that if the most suitable place for the phase detector, this one, is in the thalamus. Because remember, we need the two massive inputs for these neurons. And in this system, the place which holds two massive inputs is the thalamus, which receives the brainstem input and the cortical feedback. And it is indeed known that this neurons function is in an AND gate mode, the thalamic neurons. Then we said this is the most probable place for the phase detector to be, and we went to the thalamus to record.
So wait, the other thing, go back. I mean, you also have data that shows the rate going down with frequency. Since any adaptation will give you that, that's somehow not so strong.
Right. This is also a specific of the model. This is also a prediction of the model that the rate will go down, but it's not specific to the model. Any adaptation a mechanism will do it. So this is why we don't pay attention so much to the fulfillment of this prediction. And we take this one, which is counterintuitive, and we look for it.
But then, Omega Sensei, on those cells, like you show the rate going down in frequency, this is external drive frequency. If you looked at those, if by chance you look at those same cells and you were pumping glutamate, and just look at the, you know, sort of how
they increase the frequency with pumping glutamate. But
they increase the frequency, but that's, is there, I mean, do they tend to burst? So
if you look at the non-oscillatory neurons.
Yeah.
We didn't analyze them so systematically, but generally they increase the firing rate.
But none of these were bursting cells. We got where the rate you had was due to the interburst timing. And none of them were sort of these classic pyramidal cells that go and it's really
Because of the glutamate, you know?
Yeah, that they actually burst. Instead of producing a single spike.
That could be. Yeah.
I'm trying to see if there's a control experiment that saves this somehow. Because the ideal control experiment would always show in the cell.
It saves the decrease of the.
Yeah, that shows that somehow I can fire the cell up in principle up to very high rate.
You can increase the firing of the. Oh, you mean if the input frequency, okay. So the test should be to go to a high frequency like this and to put some glutamate in the vicinity of this cell and to see if you can drive it up. Here's an idea you can. I mean, this is one spike per second. It's very, very low firing rate. Probably you can. But what, since this is deep, you know, you can apply different mechanisms for this, we focus on this delta P prediction, which is a strong one, which is the strongest prediction of the model. So very soon, actually, we found ourselves recording also from the brainstem because, as I showed you, the thalamus information forced us to go down. And actually, we recorded from all the basic stations of these two, the meniscal and paralemniscal pathways, going from the whiskers to the chromosomes. And
these measures, is there direct input to thalamus?
No, it goes to the brainstem, then to thalamus, then to cortex, but in two parallel pathways.
And
it skips the brainstem, goes from retina to thalamus. Yeah. Here now, it goes through the
brainstem. And David, I think the difference is in the retina, you already have three cell synapses of processing, and I think if that adds up all this, the number of synapses is conserved.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so there's much of spatial information known about the lemniscal system, and practically nothing was known about the temporal one. And this is why we had to go to all these stations to study them, and I'll show you the highlights of this study. What we did, we stimulate, in this case with 8 Hz, again with ELPA. So we moved the whiskers at some frequency, in this case in 8 Hz. And we record that in the different stations. So in the brainstem, one station of the brainstem, what we see is the following. This is a raster display. So every line is one train of stimulations. And every black dot is a spike. And you see that the brainstem responses are very robust. For every movement of the whisker, they just fire continuous burst. It goes from here to here, to burst, and then shut off for the remaining, and then fire again, etc. And if you plot the PSTH, probability of firing for the first cycle, and the average of the last three cycles, you get practically the same. These are the thick and the thin lines here. The same is true for the other, interpolaris nucleus, which is the other major brainstem nucleus, the same picture. The thalamus show different picture. In the lemniscal pathway, in the well-known pathway, which is analogous to the MGM. What you see, if you see, one might call it a simple adaptation, but basically what you see is amplitude reduction. The response to the first stimulus is strong, the thick line, and then it rapidly adapts until it's stabilized on a lower amplitude response, but the latency is roughly constant, the same. In the other channel, you see this surprising phenomena, which is a latency coding. Which is a latency shift. the response to the first cycle has some low latency, but very soon, after half a second, the response stabilizes on high latency. You see that all the spikes are aligned at much higher latency from the stimulus onset, which is the green line. And if you align the two PSTHs, one on top of the other, you see that this part is missing. As if, see, the remaining of the response is the same, but the first part of the response is missing at the steady state condition. And now if you go to the cortex, the surprising thing is that you don't see a transformation from thalamus to cortex, per se, but what you see is a preservation in each pathway, a preservation of the thalamic pattern in the cortex. So you see amplitude reduction in layer 4, in the bars themselves, in layer 4, which are the inputs from the VPN here, so the distal one. All the dark staining are the same system. And the light staining is the parallel discal system, preserve the thalamic pattern. Also, the first part of the response is missing in the steady state. Now we go to the test of the prediction, which is the dependency on the frequency. And we apply four different frequencies. And we color code them. As you see in the brainstem, there is no difference between the different frequencies. We plot now the average response during steady state to a single pulse.
In the previous model, you talked about a feedback loop with a memory of 1, when alpha was like close to 1.
This is steady state.
But here you're going into steady state.
Steady state, right. I'll go back to the dynamics of the model, but this is now steady state. So we first tested the prediction in steady state. This is the easier case, and just apply different set points, different frequencies, to see if the system stabilizes on different set points, different latencies and spike points. So in the brainstem, nothing happens. This is like a relay. In the thalamus, things start to happen. There is an amplitude code of the frequency in the VPM. So amplitude goes down, but latency is constant. And there is a latency code in the POE. If frequency goes up, the latency is increased. The onset latency. Note that the offset latency is roughly the same. So it's, again, as if the first part of the response is missing, okay? But the remaining is the same. Similar picture you get in the cortex. Okay, amplitude coding here and latency coding here in the two channels. So if you want to test these predictions, we say, okay, the prediction is fulfilled only for the parallel meniscal pathway. Here we don't have any change in latency. Latency is constant. So PLLs, if they work, they can work only between these two stages, the cortex and thalamus of the parallel meniscal system, but not the other one. Okay. Now, just to show the robustness of this latency coding, we compare here the VPM and POM. We take all the single units, and now in this series of experiments, what we did is we make lesion at the end of each recording, because you see the distance from one system in the cortex to the other is only 1 to 200 microns. So we have to make sure where we record from each experiment. So we make lesion after each experiment. We keep the animal. We make the histology. It takes 2-3 days, and then if we knew exactly that it's within the station, we took the data. If it was unclear, we didn't take the data. So about half of the data was wrong. But this is another advantage of the rat. You cannot do it in the monkey. Cheaper. And also in the monkey, actually, probably these two systems are mixed together. Only the rat is generous enough to separate VPN, the Lumisca from the power of the scan in the thalamic level. These are the example of the lesions. So this we assure that it's in the VPN, this we assure it's in the POM. But somewhere that, I'm sure we didn't take. Now if you take all of those that we were sure about, and now you normalize the PSTHs and just plot them one on top of the other, you can see here that all these single units, the latency is constant, while the latency goes up with the frequency here. And these are the distributions of the frequencies.
So can you go back to the previous picture? So the VPM response has sort of two features. I mean, I could argue its latency also increased. If I look at that in that particular example, if I look at the because if I look at the time to peak,
yeah,
it's very short and then it becomes very long because there's some.
To the absolute peak, to the second peak.
Well, to the first. I mean, if
to
we
the
just
first one?
The first peak adapts out more strongly than the second peak. I mean, that's.
Yes.
You're just saying you're ignoring that on average. You're saying on average this is.
No, I'm saying in the time scale that is relevant for the 10 Hertz oscillations, it's negligible because it could be 1-2 milliseconds. So it's not a time delay that can explain, that can work. I mean, we need a temporal delay that can work along the entire working range, which is, say, if it's 125 milliseconds whisking cycle, you want it from 60 milliseconds to, sorry, you want down. You go down from, say, 100 milliseconds to 200 milliseconds or so. And this 1-2 milliseconds shift here will not work, but it could work for high frequencies.
You think maybe this is up building for like a roughness task? Or
yes,
something.
Okay. So what David refers to is that now we talk only about this whisking thing. The whisking thing, I didn't mention it here, but the whisking thing, okay, so I'm just thinking about the coding in the...
I'm kind of a red allergist, so I don't think people are even patient.
In the whisking case is that we have this whisking, and we have the burst from the brain set coming here. And actually all the encoding, so this is the red, this is the whisker going from here to here. This is space, and this is time. All the encoding stuff occurs in the forward movement of the whisking. The whisking moves and actually scan the environment. They sample what is there. If there's object there, they will hit it at some point. If it's here, it will evoke some firing in this place. In this time, if it's further along, it will evoke some firing in further time. So the encoding story of the temporal encoding here, the delta T, is running from here to here, for the space of movement and for temporal window of, say, 60 to 80 milliseconds. So these are the delta T's that are relevant. The 1-2 milliseconds is not a large enough range. But when the whiskers go across a texture and they scan a texture, then it's again like with the finger, it depends on the velocity on the density of the texture. Then you can go to very high frequencies up to 100 Hertz and 500 Hertz, etc. Then it might be relevant, these temporal delays, but not for the whisking.
What do the autocorrelograms look like? I mean, you're talking about rate coding here, but what about the autocorrelograms? Did you actually plot them?
Autocorrelograms here?
In the brainstem, thalamus, and the cortex.
Well, they follow the stimulus. If they are stimulus driven, so they follow the stimulus, just the period of the stimulus. They just what?
I think he's asking if there's really some residual oscillation left in these cells. But if you factored out the stimulus-driven part underneath,
after you stop the stimulus, something.
Or just factor out the stimulus-driven part.
No, you get nothing. It's all stimulus-driven.
You can have it on. You have to do the whole thing over.
Yeah. Okay.
So give me a little.
Whatever. Okay, let's see what are the important things to show you. Okay, now about the implementation. So we talk about the end gating in the thalamus. This is demonstrated by this missing part of the response that we talked about. So the issue of the overlap, the thalamic response will respond only during the overlap period between the cortical input and the brainstem input, is consistent with this figure that shows that the first part of the response is missing, but it's not that the entire response is delayed, but it ends at the same point, because it ends when the brainstem input ends. It cannot go further than this. Okay, there's some data showing that layer 2-3 show integration of the two channels. So one channel ends in layer 4, the other, the parallel miscan layer 5A, and layer 2-3 shows some integration of the two. We'll not go into details of this. Let me show maybe the important thing that I want to show you, and then we'll stop. Okay, so about, you wanted to know about the temporal modulations. The temporal modulations, the prediction would be that if we change the frequency is the black one, okay, as a function of time. Frequency of the input, we keep it constant for a while, and then we modulate it from cycle to cycle. So we change the frequency every cycle. This is the black line. Prediction would be that the latency will follow, because latency depends linearly with the frequency. Latency should follow these frequency modulations, and the spike count will show a mirror image of it, because it is the reverse. It has the reverse dependency. When frequency goes up, spike count goes down. Okay, so this would be the test for the dynamics of the model. And what you see is, so this is a three-dimensional PSTH picture. This is the stimulus frequency, and this is a local population, average local population in the cortex.
So what's the y-axis? I'm sorry. This is.
So we have three dimensions.
Is it neuron number or trials?
No. This is time,
right.
And at every time slice going like this, every time slice like this, we have a PSTH, and the PSTH is average of the local population over 36 repetitions.
Wait, so the x-axis is time?
It's time. And along this time, the frequency is modulated.
Okay.
Now we look at the PSTH of the response, of cortical response, as if we took average of 100 or so.
So the other axis is also time, it's short time?
Yeah, this axis is time, of the PSTH time, right, short time.
Short time.
PSTH time for only each cycle. So each cycle like this is expanded that way, to the depth.
So the neurons are oscillating a little bit.
Right, they oscillate from cycle to cycle. They respond at every cycle.
Is that what those...
You
have little mountains that are dribbling
water. Oh, these ones?
Yeah.
Well, forget about it. No, this is not the time.
Why show it? It's compressed the whole thing.
they might be important, but they're small. I mean, the big thing is that the latency goes in and out. Okay? What you see is that the response, the first one part of the response is eaten out, is missing. Okay, it was supposed to be to start from here. If it's brainstem, I'll show you. This is three-dimensional. Let me go to the... If we now just look from the above... Oops. I skipped it. If we look from above... Now, above. So, this is time. This is the PSTH time, so this is this time expanded, and the color axis is the height, the amplitude of the PSTH. You can see that in the brainstem, the picture is constant. For every cycle, the response is constant regardless of the frequency of the stimulus. This is brainstem, this is a relay. Forget about layer 4 for a moment. In layer 5A now, in the parallel miscal one, what we see is that the latency, we have these dips. Latency increases as the frequency, this is now the latency to half of the height. So the latency goes up when the frequency goes up, and the spike count, if I just measure now the spike count in a cycle, how many spikes in each cycle, it goes down.
So you claim this is strong data in support of that prediction?
So this is a strong data, yes, in support of this prediction in the fast time scale. Now it's not steady state, but it's actual decoding, cycle to cycle decoding when you modulate the input. And it does not occur in the lemniscal. So it occurs only in one system, which is the parallel lemniscal. And I think the last thing I'll show you is another, the last prediction that we tested, which is has to go with the following thing.
So wait, Edward, if I take you seriously, you're saying it's only in the meniscal system.
In the paralemniscal.
Sorry, paralemniscal system. And there's this spatial coding. So they, you propose that if you had to lesion one barrel, okay, in the barrel, not barrel, but
Baroloid, in the thalamus.
In the thalamus, right?
Yeah.
You're going to have a deficiency in one position with one whisker. Is that correct?
So assuming that spatial coding is being dealt by the lemniscal, by the other system, which is indeed our theory, like one dealing with the temporal, the other with the spatial. Now, if you lesion one baroloid there, you'll impair the spatial resolution around this whisker, because one baroloid there is responsible for one whisker. And then if you'll put an object around this whisker in the vertical dimension, in which space is involved, I didn't focus on that, but so the spatial decoding around this whisker will be impaired. Yes, this is a prediction.
You're trying to do this?
We will do it. It's not so difficult. Yeah, this is doable. Okay, so now the prediction is the following. So we said that this is, you know, putting this phase loop in nice words, we said we have a cortical prediction for the timing of the input, and we compare this prediction with the actual timing in the thalamus. This is another way just to show the phase loop. And the comparison is done here in the thalamus by the gating function. So we have the first part of the response is eaten out, and only the remaining part goes is transmitted to the cortex. And we say that this loop is the one that is responsible for this delta T. But there could be another mechanism. There could be some feed-forward mechanism that just translates frequency to delta T somehow by fatigue of synapses or something like this, which could explain this delta T. So the prediction of a pure latency code, which is not a closed loop driven, is that if you now change something in the input, let's say we change the pulse width, instead of a long stimulus cycle, we take a short stimulus cycle. This should not, and we keep the same frequency, this should not impair this latency coding. So the latency coding should be the same even with short pulses, because the frequency is the same. Okay? But if you talk about this closed loop, the closed loop depends on the error signal. The signal that keeps this latency coding is the output of this AND gate correlator. If you shorten now the input pulse, this will cause a shortening of the output burst. If you have a shortening of the output burst, the error signal now will tell the circuit that it is in the wrong, it's not in the set point, and it will drive it to a lower latency in order to keep the error signal in the set point. And this is the set point of this given frequency. So there are two different predictions from a feed-forward latency coding system and a closed loop. The closed loop will make sure that the error signal keeps kept constant, and the latency code will make sure that the latency is kept constant per given frequency. So this is easy to test. This is why we picked up this prediction. We just gave two different pulse widths. And in the brainstem, just what we see is that the response is shortened. And in the thalamus, what we see, the VPN doesn't care. I mean, the response, the latency is again short. But in the PRM, what you see is the latency code almost vanished. You see all these latencies, large latencies here, are shrink now down to this small range, and the area under the curves remains roughly the same. Quantitatively, if you look at it, and we compare the two in the PRM, we see that the latency coding as a function of frequency, with the long pulse width, it was significant dependency between the latency and the frequency, which went down very much when we shortened the pulse width, but the spike count remained the same. The error signal of the loop remained the same. And we just tested the same thing in the cortex and in the paralemniscal layers, and it looks even more beautiful than in the thalamus for some reason. The spike count is exactly the same, while the latency coding goes down significantly. So this we take as an evidence that we have a closed loop operation here that takes care, make sure that the error signal will, the spike count will remain constant per frequency and not the latency. So it does it on the expense of the latency coding. I guess, yeah, this will be enough. Thanks.